Call facilities.
This table?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Good evening and happy new year, everyone.
Happy day here.
Glad to be here. Glad to get back to work. I'd like to call to order the city council meeting of January the 2nd, 2018. Our study session this evening is for a 100th Avenue Northeast roadway design project update. And following the study session, we will go into an executive session to review the performance of a public employee and expect to reconvene our regular meeting at approximately 7:30. If we could go around the table and identify ourselves for the record, please.
Jay Arnold.
John Pascal.
Tom Neer.
Kurt Triplett.
Kathy Brown.
Laura Drake.
Toby Nixon.
Dave Asher.
Penny Sweet. And Amy Wallen. Thank you very much, City Manager.
Okay, thank you. Welcome back, everybody. Happy day. So tonight we're going to be talking about the 100th Avenue Northeast corridor improvements, and we're just really looking for input and comments and thoughts. Obviously, this is a huge multi-million-dollar potential investment in a regional arterial that also affects one of our big business districts up in the north end. So we want to get it right, and we want to make sure it reflects what the council's interested in. So we're looking for your feedback, and then we'll be back to you, I think, multiple times with this project in the future as well. But here to give you the overview is our project engineer, Laura Drake. So, Laura, take it away.
Great. So I'm Laura. I'm with the Capital Improvement Program, and I'm here to chat about my project, the 100th Avenue Corridor Improvements. So we're going to go through the preferred alternatives, recap, and some new information. Then we'll go talk about the timeline and some upcoming grant opportunities. And finally, we're going to talk about the Fire Station 24 right-of-way dedication, which was mentioned in the recent memo. Great. So we're going to chat about five design elements, the non-motorized improvements, which span the entire corridor from 132nd Street all the way up to 145th Street. We'll talk about the intersection of Juanita Woodinville Way, and then we'll talk about the Simons Road Northeast intersection, the extent of the right-of-way for the corridor, and then the Cedar Creek Culvert. Great. So first up, non-motorized improvements. So to recap what we chatted about last time, we looked at three different alternatives. The first two have the bicycle lane on the roadway next to the cars, just like a typical roadway section. The first two just vary in widths of the sidewalk landscaping and bicycle lane. The third option is the preferred alternative, and we've moved the bicycle lane up to elevate it next to the sidewalk. So, and then there will be a landscaping strip separating the elevated bicycle lane from the roadway. And this is our recommendation to council because it's the alternative that promotes safety and is most in line with the recently updated Complete Streets Ordinance. And also, it happens to have the lowest construction cost, which is always good news.
Mr. Nixon.
So in other cities I visited, like Frankfurt and Amsterdam, that have the bike lanes next to the sidewalks, they do them in a different color pavement or a different surface or something. Would that be the plan here as well?
Yep. We're actually looking at two techniques. So the sidewalk we're proposing to be just normal concrete, like a normal sidewalk. The bicycle lane, we'd actually pave it like asphalt.
Okay.
So it would be a color difference, a texture difference. And then to go one step more, we're proposing a small strip right on the edge of the concrete where we'd kind of indent it. So it'd be sort of like a
rumble strip.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We needed them to be at the same elevation so that we wouldn't have any trip hazards, but we want to make it really clear that they're two separate facilities that are side by side.
Okay.
Ms. Sweet, then Mr. Neer.
I'm just wondering, when we do these projects, do we evaluate the use of pervious pavements?
We do. I know the city has some evolving thoughts about pervious pavement as far as the maintenance aspect of it. And for this project, we happen to be able to meet all of the stormwater requirements without using pervious.
Okay. Mr. Neer.
We've got the straightaway here, but as you come to the corner,
mm-hmm.
is there a curb cut that makes that a smooth, no need to detour, kind of a path for the bicyclist?
Yes.
Okay.
So when you approach the corners, the pedestrians, they have a curb ramp, like they do everywhere. And then the bicycle lane will also have their own independent ramp that goes down. So as you're approaching the corners, you'll see that landscape buffer strip go away and the two facilities separate slightly.
So, again, from a bicyclist perspective, do I need to swerve one way or the other to go down, or I just go straight right down onto the road level and back to, on the other side and up?
It'll be pretty smooth. There might be...
But straight. I don't need to swerve.
Yeah, it won't be a big swerve or anything like that.
Thanks.
Great.
But there would be kind of a swerve at the beginning and the end of the project when you're realigning over to the bike lane on the street.
We would do that with the a bicycle crosswalk. So it'd be like a regular pedestrian crosswalk, but the standard practice now is to do green instead of white stripes.
Okay. Because I assume like south of 132nd, we would leave the bike lanes in the street like they are now.
Yeah. So it would, if you're heading southbound, you'll be up on the elevated section. You'll go down your curb ramp, follow the crosswalk, which will lead you right to the existing street level bicycle lane.
Okay.
Mr. Neer.
Sorry, I should have asked this earlier, but how did it come out cheaper? What is it that caused that?
That is a really great question. Yeah.
And I'll add, it doesn't always.
No.
In this case, it did.
Wouldn't have thought so, but
yeah, so it has to do with how you treat stormwater. So with these numbers, we looked at if you can separate the stormwater facilities. So if it's in the roadway, it's considered pollution generating. Even if it's a bicycle lane where they don't actually generate pollution, it's still in the roadway, so it's considered pollution generating, and you'd have to treat that water. And with the moving the bicycle out of the roadway, it's no longer considered pollution generating. So you don't have to do the same level of treatment.
And basically, you're expanding the sidewalk instead of expanding the driving lane. So
is that then in the surface water treatment and the piping and everything else?
Correct.
Where you're...
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So I'm going to bring you down towards the south end of the project to the Juanita Woodinville Way Northeast intersection. So last time when I was here, we talked about three alternatives. The first alternative is very similar to what's out there today. So in these pictures, north is to the right. So on the east side of the roadway, we'd be maintaining the pedestrian refuge islands that are out there today. And then on the west side, we'd maintain all the driveway access as it is today. With the second alternative, again, the access on the west side is maintained. On the east side, we take away those pedestrian refuge islands, kind of tighten up the intersection, and that allows us to have extra space for community gateway features. So that might be art installations or grass areas, benches, or just nice open space. The third alternative is the same as the second, except we're proposing to close the driveway access on the west side. So that's just the driveway at the intersection itself. All other driveways access would be very similar to what it is today.
Question for you, Laura. Sorry to interrupt.
Mm-hmm. Laura, it makes me think of 124th up there by Starbucks and that storage area, and how that parking lot has kind of turned into an alternative to 124th.
Mm.
Is that a possibility of how this is going to work for those businesses?
It could be a possibility. So here I have a map for you guys. Red is the drivable pathways that are accessible today that with the preferred alternative would remain. And then dark blue, we're showing how vehicles can turn into the properties. And light blue, it's a little hard to see, sorry. It's showing how vehicles would exit the properties onto the roadways. So there is the potential that cars can drive back and forth through these parcels, but they can do that today. And I know from my personal experience, I drive this way to work. You know, sometimes the area right where the Starbucks is, right, it does get a little jumbled up with the cars in there, and it sort of deters traffic from going through there. And with this alternative, it would likely be similar.
Okay.
Mr. Pascal, Mr. Arnold, and Mr. Nixon.
So we heard pretty overwhelmingly from the public that this was something that they really wanted to see, was to address the problems that, you know, I think most people experience with that west leg. And I think it's a good concept to further consider. Mm-hmm. I guess the question that I had, and I know that we talked about this earlier, is just to make sure that we're not moving a problem elsewhere to one of the other driveways. And while those driveways exist today, they would likely get additional traffic with the closure of the west leg. And so can you tell for certain that we aren't moving a problem elsewhere, or have you done that analysis to demonstrate that?
For this project, we did look at the vehicle counts that are at the intersection, but we don't actually have the numbers for the other driveways that are not at the intersection. So that's definitely something we could go back and look at and crunch the numbers. You know, but I talked to the design team about this quite a bit, and from their professional experience, they see we have six driveway options that would remain for the public, and drivers, you know, pick the path of least resistance, and we would expect drivers to spread out amongst the driveways. And if you're driving down in the driveway, the first driveway, if it's really backed up, you're going to cruise past and go into the second or third or fourth driveway.
Yeah, I guess it would be nice to just confirm that, because I would agree with you. People do choose the path of least resistance, mm-hmm. but when I drive that, I don't see that happening, because I see the traffic backing up onto 100th Avenue. And me, I wouldn't logically do that mm-hmm. just because I'd be concerned someone would rear end me. But people do that. And yeah. So I think for me, I'd feel a little bit more comfortable just making sure we're not creating another problem elsewhere.
Okay, great. We will definitely take a look at that.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold and Mr. Nixon.
Laura, along the lines of what John was asking, can you talk specifically about where you expect the northbound traffic to get into that shopping center? Because what's shifting here, and also, I guess, westbound traffic coming on 180 Woodinville Road, because what's mm-hmm. shifting here is what's a controlled intersection to several uncontrolled driveways.
Right.
And so... wondering if we're expecting people to go all the way to the far north driveway if they're mm-hmm. turning left across traffic.
Mm-hmm.
What's the expectation?
Great. So for our design, we expect vehicles, if they're needing to make a left turn movement into the driveway, we're expecting them to pick a spot where it's a two-way dual left turn lane. So you have a safe space to merge over, watch traffic, wait for a clear opening, and then make your movement. And to help reinforce that, we're also proposing to put C-curb to prohibit dangerous turn movements. And it's interesting. So Christian Knight does public outreach for us, and he was chatting with some folks that they actually run a small business out of a home in the Cedar Juanita condos. And so that gentleman was saying when he comes into work to get up there, he has several different routes that he picks. One of the more common ones he uses is to go south on Juanita Woodinville, go into the signalized driveway right there, and wander around the parking lot to get back into that condo area. And his perspective was that he changes his routes based on, you know, what Google Maps is telling him is the fastest mm-hmm. way, and what experiences he's had recently out there. And even though his most common way of getting to work is to go through that driveway we're proposing to be closed, he's really supportive of this project. When he comes in the morning, sometimes he has a problem where he's trying to get into that signalized driveway and just kind of gets stuck there. And, you know, it can just be a little bit dangerous feeling for him. So we chatted about what is he going to do. So if he is going to come southbound on Juanita Woodinville, he can either make a right onto 100th Avenue and then go left into that second driveway, that's the 134th Court, and go through the parking lot there. Or he has the option to go left to go southbound on 100th and then pop in at the make a right into the first driveway there.
Okay, so just to be clear, within the box there, those two would be C curb to prevent left turns. And so any left turns that would be happening from northbound 100th would happen on the 1 through 2nd and by the U.S.
The first one looks like it allows left turns.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to see right here on the left side of the box.
Okay.
We've actually channelized it, so it's a small section where it's a two-way left turn pocket.
Okay.
So there is a small area of refuge space for just to hold a car, maybe two cars, okay. To help with that movement. But for the driveway just to the south, we're proposing to add C curb there to prevent that, and same with the driveway to the north. You know, it's not ideal to restrict movements, but if it just feels safe or unsafe, you know, you need to accommodate that.
Okay. And are there plans to monitor for whatever alternative we choose afterwards and potentially adjust depending on how much business the Juanita Collision Center is getting because of these changes?
You know, one of the big elements of this project is improving our ITS network, the Intelligent Transportation System. And part of that is video detection for vehicles and also surveillance cameras so we can see from right here in the Traffic Management Center what's going on. So I know Chuck and Iris are definitely going to keep their eye on the whole corridor when it as the changes happen, and we'll be monitoring it really closely.
One other thing, just real quickly, that we talked about maybe doing this morning is just doing a test closure before we make any final decisions and see how it works. You know, put up a reader board and say it's temporary and see if any of these problems that and scenarios that we're thinking might happen, do they really happen, and how do drivers really behave? So that might be a way to give us all some assurance that we've thought it through completely.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Nixon?
Yeah, a couple things. First, have we had conversations with the businesses there, particularly the Starbucks, about their drive-through queue management?
Because mm-hmm.
I know, like, the 7-Eleven folks would probably be very upset if the Starbucks queue ended up blocking the parking of the 7-Eleven. And the reason I ask that is... we were pretty aggressive in how we required Chick-fil-A to manage their drive-through queue. And I'd like us to do more of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we know there's a business that has a very active drive-through, we shouldn't allow the queuing to go into the street. There needs to be a way to stop that from happening and require them to do the kind of things that Chick-fil-A did to map out how they're going to have a long queue on their own property. So what's been done along those lines?
Yeah, you bring up some really good points. I think, you know, if these buildings were going in now with our rules, we would not have these issues that we do today. But, you know, since this area is annexed and we have what we have, we've gone out and had several conversations with the owner of the Starbucks building. There's a couple other tenants in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also met with the folks at the 7-Eleven there. Both are opposed to closing the driveway. They're concerned it would negatively impact their businesses. The funny thing about 7-Eleven is what they see today is vehicles entering that driveway at the intersection and queuing up, which prohibits cars trying to access the 7-Eleven parking lot from that same way. Mm-hmm. It's just a line of cars. You can't get through it. So while they're concerned that less cars would choose to pull over there. You know, talking with the design team about it, we expect that the queuing problems wouldn't be quite so bad for 7-Eleven. There's a good bit of space kind of right in that where that dashed red line is,
mm-hmm.
right in there. So if cars were queuing up properly, there would still be enough space to get around the queue to go where you're trying to go. We did, as I mentioned, talk to the owner of the Starbucks building several times. He did bring a representative from Starbucks the more recent time. I think for them, you know, they would be very disappointed if this driveway access was removed. You know, we've reminded them that we're we're still providing them access. They still get to keep a driveway, and it's in line with our policies, and we have safety concerns. I think for them, they have mentioned that they have been interested or thinking about redeveloping their parking lot space anyways. So my consultant was able to kind of throw together a couple very conceptual level ideas, showing them how they could potentially redevelop their site to maintain the parking and pull the queue, the driveway queue, away from the parking so that, you know, people can get in and out of the parking lot without the queue blocking them in.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up also on the question that Councilmember Sweet had. Comparing this to southbound 116th, coming down to 124th, and my perception of the problem there is that DOT just has done a terrible job of programming the signal, and the traffic backs up from 124th all the way up to 128th, and only two or three or maybe four cars get through going southbound through per light. It's crazy. And we've talked to them many, many times about fixing it, and they haven't done anything. I don't see us having that problem here. When in heavy periods, when the traffic or when the signal turns green for southbound 100th, it stays green a lot longer there than it does on 116th. Mm-hmm. So I think the temptation for people to cut through is much less. That's just my observation anyway.
No, I agree, and I think, I mean, the problem is so basic up there at that corner that, I mean, that parking lot by the Value Village is a ridiculous obstacle course.
It's a lot of cut-through traffic.
Yeah.
Mr. Ash?
No.
Okay.
Well, the really great thing about this corridor is we own and operate signals ourselves, so.
We can fix it.
Great. So in closing, this is the preferred alternative because it best reflects the complete streets ordinance. By improving safety, it also consolidates driveways to be in line with our city policies. And it's actually slightly cheaper to close the driveway than it is to keep it open.
And this was the Transportation Commission's recommendation?
It was. Great. So we'll pop on up to the north end of the intersection and talk about the Simons Road intersection. So when we were here last time, we talked about three different alternatives. The first was the no stop right turn from people going eastbound on Simons to go south on 100th. And that one only had two pedestrian crosswalks. The south leg did not have the crosswalk to accommodate that free right movement. The second alternative had a split phasing with a northbound left through lane. So essentially, northbound, as you're approaching the intersection, there's three lanes. The rightmost lane is a through only. The center lane is a through and a left. And the leftmost lane is a left only lane. And the third alternative was the dual protected lefts for northbound. So one through northbound lane, two northbound left turn lanes onto Simons Road. And both options two and three had the south leg crosswalk. So we're recommending alternative three because it maintains the full pedestrian connectivity and has an improved level of service over alternative two. And I know there were some questions about level of service as far as do we put four lanes or five lanes between Simons Road and 145th. So earlier in the project, when we were still talking about that free right turn, the no stop turn from eastbound Simons to go southbound on 100th, we looked at, well, can we put in a crosswalk on the south leg? And with that alternative, we were assuming four lanes from just north of Simons all the way up to 145th. The top picture has the recommendation to council, which is the dual protected lefts, as we talked about, which has the full five lanes from Simons Road to 145th. So when we look at the level of service for the morning and afternoon, so that's how is the intersection serving the vehicles, how much wait time is there, we can see that comparing the top picture to the bottom picture, the morning level of service is improved with the recommended dual protected left turns as compared to the free right with the south leg crosswalk. I think there were some questions about, you know, do we really need five lanes from Simons all the way up to 145th? It does add some cost to the project because of retaining walls, paving, et cetera. And for this corridor, we looked really closely at where the volume's coming from and how much volume is there. There's a good bit of volume coming southbound from Bothell down into Kirkland, but there's also a really large amount of vehicles coming westbound from 145th, making that turn left to go southbound on 100th, mm-hmm. and that adds quite a bit of volume. You know, we're expecting volumes to go up, and we just really want to do it right the first time, mm-hmm. and it's our recommendation to council to do the full five-lane section to accommodate that extra volume.
Thank you. Mr. Pascal.
This was one of the questions I mm-hmm. had for staff earlier that we talked about, but looking at the two alternatives, and you look at the Simons Road intersection, the main difference is that AM peak hour, where the four-lane concept seems to not do as well as the five-lane goes mm-hmm. from, it's a D under the five-lane, and it's an E under the four-lane concept. And the question I had for staff was really the only difference is that why would that be so different at that intersection? Because you have the same number of lanes actually entering that intersection from all directions. But one of the lanes in the four-lane concept is a right turn only lane. Even though there's two southbound lanes heading, towards Kirkland, why couldn't that just be a through right? And did you evaluate it that way? And if you did, was the level of service closer to the five lane? Because if it was, then obviously I would choose a lower cost, lower impact yep. option if it had the same performance or similar performance as the more expensive, more impactful option. So did you confirm with the design team whether or not that's how they analyzed it, or?
Yeah, so they analyzed it as the alternatives that are up here, which is not exactly apples to apples as far as what's happening at Simons. As you point out, the lower image has the right turn only lane for southbound and then a southbound through, as opposed to two southbound through lanes. So down here at Simons, so with the preferred alternative, we're showing one southbound through that can also take a right, one dedicated southbound through lane here. And then for the other alternative, it was a right turn only lane. It's a pocket that appears as you're heading southbound. And then there's the one southbound through lane.
So John, your comment is that lane went straight through, would that keep it the same?
Could it be, instead of just a right turn only lane, because not many people are turning right in the morning, they're basically going south into Kirkland, a lot of people traveling to Totem Lake, Evergreen Hospital, wherever. Could that be a through right? Mm-hmm. And then you still get the similar performance at the intersection, and then perhaps the two alternatives are more equal from a performance standpoint, but one is less costly, less impactful for pedestrian, the width of pedestrian crossing, for you have a little bit more space, you don't have to put in retaining walls, those type of things. That's the only thing. That was the question I had. I mean, I'm not opposed to the five lane. I think it's probably worth spending a little bit more time just confirming that before, you spend a lot of extra dollars doing a wider concept. That's all. That was kind of my
yeah.
concept.
So if I can just talk real quick about why we're looking at these two images that aren't you know, just the difference in four lane versus five lane. There's also some minor differences at the Simons intersection, the southern intersection of the two. When we were looking at the first three alternatives originally, the free right, so that's people heading eastbound on Simons turning right to go southbound on 100th, right up here, that without the South Lake crosswalk, it actually operated the best for drivers as far as level of service, just because there's a huge volume of traffic that's headed eastbound on Simons turning right to go southbound on 100th. You know, we went to the Transportation Commission. We heard back how important it is to Kirkland that we maintain the pedestrian access. So we went back and looked at that option to add back in that South Lake crosswalk so that there's full pedestrian connectivity. So we started with the option, the alternative, that had the best level of service overall. We added the South Lake crosswalk, and it ended up with a level of service that's worse than the dual protected lefts. So in my mind, I think that's an indication of how important it is for the two southbound lanes. However, we have not confirmed that with analysis. We've confirmed that having the free right from Simons and having the South Lake crosswalk, it's worst level of service compared to the preferred alternative. But we can definitely take a closer look at doing the dual protected lefts at Simons and what it would look like to have one southbound lane approaching and a second through right appear as you're approaching the intersection. So next time I'm back, I will have an answer for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nixon and Mr. Asher.
So I will say I'm with Councilmember Pascal on this. When I look at this, it looks to me like it would be good to have everything from Simons south be like it is on the bottom map, mm-hmm. but everything from Simons north be like it is on the upper map, right? Because that way you would maximize your throughput southbound during the morning rush, and you'd maximize your throughput northbound in the evening rush. And what we might do is talk to Bothell even about changing the north leg at 145th so that the right lane was a through right also, mm-hmm. because there's not many people that turn right to go up the hill there during the morning rush. There's a lot of people that are heading southbound, mm-hmm. and if they could divide into two southbound lanes before they got to the intersection, you double potentially the throughput of the intersection. I have no idea how long that right turn lane is there. Mm-hmm. But
you have to have two receiving lanes to do that. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm suggesting using the upper map for between Simons and 145th, because it gives you two lanes mm-hmm. all the way through.
Right, but I don't think that's what Councilor Pascal is saying.
Well, he was talking more about the south end of it. I'm talking more about how you get more cars southbound mm-hmm. from Bothell all the way down.
Are we sure there's a right turn lane?
Well, it's marked on the map.
Yeah.
It's for the, there's a housing development up there. I believe it's a dead end, although I'm not 100%
sure. I think you're right. Mm-hmm. So there's not many people who turn there.
Yeah.
But if that was a through lane, you could have two queues of cars mm-hmm. to be able to move through the intersection as soon as the light turned green. See what I'm getting at?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'll definitely reach out to Bothell and see what they're thinking. I mean, it would be part of our project.
Right.
Just need their concurrence, their permission.
Because all we'd be asking them to do is repaint just that one arrow.
Mr. Asher.
Thank you. Have we modeled what is going to happen when the east side of the Simons Road intersection opens up? We got some indications last year that something may be happening there. Does opening up the development in the east side there make either one of these alternatives preferable, more preferable than they are without that analysis? Mm.
I don't know, but we can definitely take a look and get back to you.
Yeah, because that's certainly going to happen before we get back to do any reconstruction or reconfiguring of this. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks, Laura.
Wonderful.
Lots of work for you to do.
Yeah. It's good. It's good. I love this project. Great. So we'll talk right now about the extent of right-of-way. The background is the corridor. Typically, it's 100 foot wide, except for a small section that's between 140th Place and Simons Road. So last time I was here, we chatted about three different alternatives. The first is the no right-of-way addition. And unfortunately, we can't fit five travel lanes with the limited right-of-way in that section. We tried to make it work, and it just doesn't fit. So if we did go with the first alternative, it would mean dropping down to one northbound and one southbound lanes in this small section. The second alternative, which is the recommended alternative, would be acquiring 20 feet of right-of-way from a parcel that's owned by King County. It's the one that I've outlined with the red box. And currently, the city attorneys have reached out to King County and started talking about it, and we're waiting for them to get back to us at this point. The third alternative is the more costly alternative, which would be to purchase all of the right-of-way needed to get a consistent 100-foot width right-of-way throughout the whole corridor. However, with the third alternative, there is a conflict with a building that's out there today, which would mean a significant impact to that parcel and also quite a bit of associated costs with just acquiring the right-of-way itself. So the second alternative is recommended to council. My consultant has estimated approximately $94,000 for acquiring the parcel with all of the paperwork involved with that. However, the city attorneys are looking into options with King County to see if we can get that at a reduced cost or potentially gifted.
They should definitely give it to us.
That's what I said.
Depends on what the real cost
is. Yeah. Yeah, so we're investigating that currently, and we're sure excited to give you guys an update once there is one. With alternative two, we're also trying to think about the future, and you know, parcels eventually will redevelop. So if and when the parcels on the west side in this section of reduced right-of-way, when they go to develop, we'll be negotiating right-of-way dedication so we can match what we have elsewhere in the corridor.
All righty.
Can I ask a question about that?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, do you have a slide that shows the profile during or in this narrower section?
I don't.
Is it just that the landscape strips go away?
The landscape strips do go away, and the lanes do narrow up. I don't know. I think it's about a foot, maybe half a foot. Narrow up just a little bit.
But do you still have separated sidewalk and bike lane?
Yeah, so it'll be... there'll be the roadway with five lanes. Mm-hmm. We'll have a 6-inch curb like normal. I think we are just showing like a 1-foot buffer so bicyclists aren't right up against the curb. Okay. And then it would be the same elevated bicycle lane and then the side-by-side pedestrian crosswalk.
The same widths as other places? Or
I believe it's the same. There might be a slight reduction just to kind of squeeze it in there, but it's within our standards.
Okay.
Mr. Pascal.
A question that was raised by a member of the public to me earlier today was, and you can just refresh my memory, mm-hmm. but they were asking about why the city isn't looking at putting a signal at like 140th. I think that's the one of the streets there. Did we look at that, and what was kind of the reasoning? Did we document the kind of the reasons why that wasn't further recommended?
Yeah, so right now that we've looked at the traffic and it just doesn't meet the warrants for a signal, the national standards. And with our projected modeling of what it would be in the future, we're also not seeing those warrants. However, you know, we don't want to create a problem. So with our preferred alternative, we're actually looking at providing spare conduits to span the 140th Place intersection. So if and when we get to a point where there's enough traffic that we could actually, that a signal would actually be warranted, we'd already have the conduit space ready to go. So, you know, we'd have to spend the money to get the poles, but we wouldn't have to dig up the roadway again.
But it doesn't preclude it from in the future.
No. Is what, yeah. No. Okay. And I know if you're looking at the map here, it looks, why would we pick 140th Place when it's a T intersection? And the reason is to the west, where it's off the map, you can't see. It has really good connectivity up into Finn Hill. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were looking at that intersection.
Mr. Asher.
Do single-family residents face onto this stretch or north of 100th?
So I believe all of the houses either face opposite 100th, if there's like a little cul-de-sac street, or they face the side street, so 140th Place, 140th Street. And where we do have extra space between their parcel and where our sidewalk's going in, if we can fit it in, we're looking at options to add some shrubbery or other physical barriers to kind of limit the roadway impacts and noise.
I couldn't remember along this stretch. What I was looking for was the where will they put their waste receptacles?
Oh, that's a great. I know,
and I can't think of any that face onto there. But
there is one. If you look on the Alt 2 map, where it says 100th Avenue,
okay,
there is a house on that property. It's just off the top of the.
Oh,
map.
Oh yeah, it's
right?
That old like shingled
yeah.
house.
Yeah, and it has that whole area is full of blackberries. Right, mm-hmm. called yeah. the Blackberry Farm.
Yeah,
but I think that's a good question. As yeah. far as I know, that's the only one that does okay. front. Directly on the street.
Yeah, I think so. When we were doing our house hunting, that was one of the things that we were looking at. I drove everywhere.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, yeah, they could put them just up the driveway because they do. It is a circular mm-hmm. driveway, and they have two.
Okay, as long as we can make some kind of accommodation. You know, we think it
through. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For that. Okay.
Great question. All right. Just north of where the right-of-way pinch point is and just south of Simons Road, there's the Cedar Creek Culvert. So Cedar Creek is a tributary of the Juanita Creek, very important creek to Kirkland. So in the surface water master plan, they've identified the crossing of Cedar Creek at 100th as not one but two full fish barriers. So on the east side, you can in the photo, it's showing the outfall. This is actually when the water levels are high. The waterfall drop is significantly more during lower flow periods. On the west side of 100th Avenue, there's a 1987 King County flow control structure. It essentially looks like a big well. So the water goes in the top, goes down this well, and when it and it has a flow regulator in there that tries to limit how much water can go through. So that's why there's two full fish barriers. And also downstream of here, there's some known issues with erosion on Cedar Creek and also on Juanita Creek. Through our investigation of the culvert, we discovered that the culvert's reaching the end of its design lifespan. It has some structural issues, and the flow control structure that's in there today is not functioning as it was when it was first put in place. So we looked at three different alternatives for what to do about this culvert. The first alternative would be to keep the culvert and try and do some structural repairs to it to increase the lifespan, but it would really only get you 10, maybe 15 additional years of life before the culvert needs to be dealt with again. And we can make some improvements to the detention system, that flow control facility, to bring it back up closer to what it was performing when it was new, but it would still be not quite up to our current standards. Alternative one is the lowest cost alternative. The second alternative would be to replace the culvert with a fish passable culvert. So we actually spent some time going back and forth with our surface water folks, the engineers, and also the maintenance personnel, and they had some concerns about the maintenance of a fish passable culvert at this location. It would remove the fish barrier for the outfall. We would design it so that barrier would go away. But if we needed to keep the flow control structure on the west side, then we would still have one fish barrier. The third alternative is to take out the culvert and make it a bridge. So essentially, we would be supporting the roadway. We drive some piers down and build the roadway on top of that so we can come in and excavate out the culvert, remove all of that, and then it'd be a nice stream that goes through, which is in line with Kirkland code that says, you know, if you can daylight a stream, you should daylight a stream. It is definitely the more expensive option of the three, but we would design it in a way that would fully remove all of the fish barriers. We'd replace the King County old detention facility with something that's easy for us to maintain and also meets all of our current standards. And
Laura, could you talk briefly about the operations on alternative two, because that is, I think, an important issue for us all to consider, because the second alternative requires manual operation, especially during high flows, and the consequences of not getting out there to raise the gates at the right time, you could actually lose the culvert and lose the road. So you want to talk a little bit about how that would function?
Yeah, that's
alternative too. Yeah.
You know, we've just done some...
acceptable alternative.
It can be done, but it is a higher risk.
Yeah, so really with this culvert, we're seeing two things that we want to fix. We want to make the flow control structure function better or replace it with something that functions a lot better. And we also want to improve the fish passage. So for the fish passable culvert option, the best design that... I guess the best idea that we've come up with is to actually do two culverts side by side, twin culverts, if you will. So one would be fully fish passable and open all the time for fish to go through. The other one would only be used during high flow periods, and it would just be to move some extra water as needed, but at a rate that we regulate. And it would require a maintenance person to go out there and activate using the high flow culvert, and then coming back to shut it off when it's no longer needed.
We don't have the technology to do it remotely.
It would be a gate, a manually raised gate, and somebody would always have to remember during peak flows. So I have concerns actually about the second alternative. I know it's less expensive. But from an ongoing operating perspective, it leaves me a little worried.
I think we've got.
Isn't that a total blockage up above it at JC 15?
It is. Yes.
Is it in the capital budget to fix that?
No. So J 15 is upstream. So removing this J 14, the culvert we're talking about, would open up that stretch, but. 15. If it's not already a project, it's in the master plan as a future project.
So I've got a line up here, Mr. Arnold, Mr. Neer, and Mr. Asher, I think.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Yes, sir.
With the preferred placement bridge alternative, does this give us opportunities with other grant funding, given that we would be removing a fish barrier and bringing things to current standards that we wouldn't necessarily get access to with the other alternatives?
I think there would be options for grant funding under either two or three. I would think that three would score higher. It's better designed, but maybe you could speak to the grant opportunities that we're anticipating for the project.
Yeah, so I talked to Kyle Butler at length about this. He's our grant coordinator here. And anytime you can go above and beyond the minimums, you'll score higher on your on your grant applications. So it's kind of interesting. We were actually looking at not just ecology-type grants, but also transportation grants as well. And there are a few where you do score significant extra points for making improvements to wildlife, to surface water, et cetera.
I don't know if JC15 is actually on the funded list, but if it is and it's planned and we can say, okay, at this point we have opened up, we've removed barriers and opened up the creek, I would think that would be significant as well.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Neer, then Mr. Asher.
Yeah, I had a similar question about the funding, which sounds like there's some possibilities. The other barriers downstream don't seem as severe. Are there any plans to deal with those as well?
Yes. I don't know right now which ones we have as funded projects and which ones are unfunded.
And I don't recall off the top of my head. They're in the Surface Water Master Plan, and we can get back to you with which ones are in the funded CIP versus the unfunded. I didn't bring the list with me.
And do we have returning fish?
I spoke with a few residents who have been there quite some time, and one in particular is just downstream of this culvert, and they said they, when they first bought the house in the 1970s, I think, they saw salmon.
There used to be salmon in it, yeah. For sure. Mm-hmm. And Juanita Creek is our only creek that has Chinook in it at all, so it's a higher priority for the tribes and for fish and wildlife to remove barriers on Juanita Creek and tributaries to Juanita than other areas in the city.
So we don't know whether there are Chinook returning now?
They can't get up to this location.
So there's no fish coming back. They're basically not.
Sometimes there's no water.
Yeah.
Anyway, if this is really fish bearing, which it has been historically, I'd love to open it up. So I'd support doing the best job we possibly can, including daylighting the road area.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see some fish in there again.
It would be lovely. And just to add one more thing, I was speaking with Jenny Gauss, who's in the Surface Water Group. And as a general rule of thumb, usually we start removing barriers downstream and work upstream. So you're opening up section by section instead of sort of working in a vacuum and then opening it all up at once. So that's why this culvert, one of the reasons why it hasn't been made an active project yet. Also because it's very expensive to do this one if you're not already touching the roadway. But for us, we're already planning on rebuilding the roadway. So I really look at this as a great opportunity that now is a great time to really think hard about this one.
Tom, I represent Kirkland on RIA 8 Salmon Recovery Council. And Kirkland's creeks have always been Tier 3, and I'm wondering if we had some of these projects up enough that it ups our potential to actually restore some salmon-bearing streams that would also open up funding.
Mr. Asher and Ms. Sweet.
I think it would be worth looking at what would it take for us to see if we can qualify for some of those easier to get gradings. Also, my comment was I hope we've had or can have our TIB magician, Steve, take a look at this. Because if there's money around, he'll know how to do that and be well worth that investment.
Yes, we have brought it to his attention.
Okay,
for sure.
Good, thank you.
Ms. Sweet,
how many tributaries are there on Juanita Creek?
On Juanita? I don't know off the top of my head because there are a lot of little streams that feed into it, but named tributaries, I can get back to you.
I'm just interested in the bang for the buck is there in other places. Mm-hmm. It feels to me like we're having a fish conversation without a lot of the fish data because we're on this particular project. And it seems like we'd need to have that whole picture before we looked at $225 million.
Mm-hmm. And we do have the data. It's not $225 million.
Oh, yeah.
it's a lot of money in any case. But I guess I think of this project or this particular location in sort of their three major problems. One is the environmental and fish habitat. Secondly, though, is the downstream erosion and flooding, and we have had some real problems with the banks being cut and property owners having issues downstream from this site, which is why the county designed the facility that is right upstream from this culvert. It doesn't work well. It was designed a long time ago. It wasn't a great design at the time, but it does detain and hold some water, and we need to continue to address that, and the current system isn't working. So it's flood control, it's habitat, and then, you know, it's a risk assessment for the roadway itself. And so those are all of the things that come into this. And the fish conversation is always interesting, and I get enthusiastic about it because I like it, but it isn't the only important thing at this site. It's all three of them.
Mr. Nixon?
I'm just thinking back to what we did on Lake Washington Boulevard, and would this have that siltation control and easy to clean aspect to it as well, or is that just not an issue here because the water moves faster?
The water moves faster, and that's the biggest problem here, but kind of similar to Cochrane Springs, the current facility is in the channel. Unlike Cochrane Springs, it doesn't work very well. So one of the things that we want to look at is, could we design something that is an overflow system that goes out of the main channel during peak flows? And maybe that's a constructed wetland, or I don't know exactly what that might be, but something that could move those high flows out of the way for a little while and then, you know, move them back in when it's not, you know, when the flows are lower. But we just are not far enough along on the design. But
that sounds like what we're thinking about doing on Forbes Creek, too.
Yeah, same kind of idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know we're running a little short on time, but just one really cool thing about the bridge. If council approves and we do end up constructing this, we can actually keep the roadway open to traffic at all times. So you'd close one half, drill down your piers, build your new roadway that's supported on those piers, open that up to traffic, and then close the other half and do the same again. So even though it's going to be more expensive to construct, it would have less impact on the traveling public.
Great. Question, Mr. Asher.
So we're looking at and expecting that this construction will happen at a different time than the roadway construction or not?
We're expecting that it would be concurrent.
Concurrent, okay.
So, yeah, first you need to lay your groundwork, mm-hmm. right? And then we'd build the road on top of it right after.
Okay.
Yes, for this project, we're going to really think hard about traffic control and, you know, controlling what the contractor's allowed to do to try and minimize impacts to everybody. So moving ahead, here's the anticipated timeline. So we've been in design for a while and we'll wrap up this year. We're targeting two big grant applications this year. The first is with the Puget Sound Regional Council. They have two different grants that we're looking at, and then also the Transportation Improvement Board later this year as well. And if we're successful with those grant, we can start construction as early as 2019.
Exciting.
Yes. And the last thing I just wanted to chat with you guys about, we found this really cool opportunity. So Fire Station 24 purchased a parcel on the northeast corner of 100th and Northeast 132nd Street. And we saw an opportunity for improving the non-motorized aspect along the south side of that parcel. So we've looked at the opportunity, the possibility of the city dedicating about 9 feet of right-of-way so that we can put in the elevated bicycle lane, sidewalk, and landscaping buffer to match the rest of 100th Avenue. So just kind of wrap around for this one short block.
Mr. Shipley.
I just say actually that idea came from Councilmember Asher, who brought that up to me quite a while ago. So this idea was actually his, and we were able to take it and do something cool with it. So.
Yeah, it is really cool. So thank you. Yep, so I think we're moving forward with this.
Mr. Pascal.
I just wanted to thank you, and this is the design team on this project. It's really cool to see it from kind of an idea like many years ago to actually kind of coming closer to be reality, and seeing that there's all this thought that's gone into every kind of design component. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. You've been with it the whole way.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Good job.
So next up is to return back to full council. We'll have questions answered, and we look forward to presenting our alternatives for formal approval.
Excellent. Great. Thank you so much, Laura. That was you did a great job presenting to the council and fielding a lot of tough questions.
I really like this project.
It shows.
I know I said it
shows
but
that
like,
you really care about
I'm
this
a transportation
project.
Nerd, and I live on this corridor in the Bothell side.
You're
and
in
it's
the
just,
right place.
It's perfect.
It worked out for us.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, guys.
All right. So we're going to go into executive session to discuss the performance of a public employee. We'll return at approximately 7:30. Thank you.
Thank you. We're live, Mayor.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first council meeting of 2018. We are back in session following a study session for a 100th Avenue Northeast Roadway design project update and an executive session to review the performance of a public employee. Ms. Anderson, would you call the roll, please?
Councilmember Nixon?
Here.
Councilmember Neer?
Here.
Councilmember Asher?
Here.
Councilmember Sweet?
Here.
Councilmember Pascal?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Here.
Mayor Wallen?
Here. Thank you very much. So it's a very special night for us. Being elected is a huge privilege, and so nice to see so many family members in the audience. So thank you for being here to support us. I'm going to throw it to Kurt to talk through the process, but I also just wanted to say Happy New Year to returning council members, to our staff. Thank you for all the hard work you do, and thanks for being here tonight. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you so much, Madam Mayor, members of the council. Happy New Year to you as well. So just briefly for the audience, family and friends and council, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to do the oath of office in alphabetical order. So what we're going to do is we have the Honorable Judge Mike Lambeau, our Kirkland Municipal Judge, is here to swear you all in. He's going to be standing up here in front of the Deputy City Managers. We'll be calling the name of the council members in order. We'll have you come down, take the oath of office, and then return to your seat. So we'll go through the five, and then when that is completed, then you're going to take your vote for mayor and deputy mayor. And then after that vote, there will be a break so you can talk to the those folks who are here to congratulate you. So, any questions on that before we begin? So, Your Honor, if you would mind stepping up to the front, then I'll call the first council member down. So can we start with Deputy Mayor Jay Arnold, please? And you may applaud after, in between the oaths, after the oath.
All right. Councilman Arnold, I ask you to raise your right hand. Do you, Jay Arnold, having been duly elected to the office of Kirkland City Council, position number one, solemnly swear that you will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office as prescribed by law and to the best of your ability, and that you will support and maintain the Constitution of the State of Washington and of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
So next we have Councilmember Tom Neer.
Do you, Tom Neer, having been duly elected to the office of Kirkland City Council, position number two, solemnly swear that you will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office as prescribed by law and to the best of your ability, and that you will support and maintain the Constitution of the State of Washington and of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations.
Next, we have Councilmember John Pascal.
All right, Ashley, raise your right hand. Thank you. Do you, John Paschal, having been duly elected to the office of Kirkland City Council, position number 7, solemnly swear that you will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office as prescribed by law and to the best of your ability, and that you will support and maintain the Constitution of the State of Washington and of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations.
Next, we have Councilmember Penny Sweet.
Congratulations, John.
Good to see you again.
You too.
All right. Councilwoman Sweet, I'll ask you to raise your right hand. Do you, Penny Sweet, having been duly elected to the office of Kirkland City Council, position number 3, solemnly swear that you will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office as prescribed by law and to the best of your ability, and that you will support and maintain the Constitution of the State of Washington and of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations.
And now Mayor Amy Wallen.
Wallen, I'll ask you to raise your right hand. Thank you. Do you, Amy Wallen, having been duly elected to the office of Kirkland City Council, position number 5, solemnly swear that you will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office and as prescribed by law, and to the best of your ability, and that will you support and maintain the Constitution of the State of Washington and of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much for being here, Your Honor. We really, really appreciate it. All right, the next item on our agenda is the election of mayor and deputy mayor. So I will call for nominations at this time. Deputy Mayor Arnold.
I nominate Amy Wallen to serve as Kirkland mayor.
A second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to nominate Amy Wallen as the mayor. Any discussion? Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to have my name entered for mayor. I'm in the last half of my last term, and up until about 10 days ago, I thought I had a commitment from you personally to support me for mayor, and today you said you recall that differently. It's three terms is really cuts the opportunity out for other people to participate, and I would appreciate the consideration. I have gotten quite an extensive 17-year experience with the council. I had the opportunity for previous times to be considered for mayor, but at those times I was in the throes of really creating a financial system at the University of Washington in an arcane system that required 18-hour days, 5 and 6 days a week. So I didn't have an opportunity to do that. So I would appreciate the consideration of the council if that's possible. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm wondering how I handle this procedurally.
I think that would be an amendment to the motion on the floor and would require a second.
So we would consider Mr. Asher's statement as a motion to elect him as mayor, correct?
To amend.
To amend.
To amend.
Oh, okay, yep. To amend the motion.
And would require a second.
Okay, thank you. My procedural rules 101. I already remember how to do this. All right. It was moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to appoint me as mayor. We now have an amendment on the floor proposed by Mr. Asher. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Neer to amend the motion to appoint Mr. Asher as the mayor. Discussion? Ms. Sweet.
The question of how we select a mayor, I've never had it, I've never seen anything like this happen before, so it's an interesting one. I believe that when we select a mayor, we do so with a clear idea of the kind of leadership we want to see at the helm of our group of seven. And it's for that reason that I do support Amy in that role. As the incoming chair of the Sound Cities Association, and as someone who I believe has done as good a job of being our mayor as anyone prior to her holding the position, I will not be able to support the amendment.
Thank you. Other comments? Mr. Arnold.
I believe there are three very important tasks in being mayor. One is representing the city and the community for various public events and ribbon cuttings and opportunities to speak before the community. There is the responsibility of running these meetings well and giving everybody a chance to air their views and make sure that we have a thorough, deliberate discussion of the issues, a thorough, deliberate, fair discussion of the issues. And there's the job of representing the council itself and representing the views of all seven of us. And on all three parts of those jobs, Mayor Wong has done an outstanding job, and I think it's very important continue for the effectiveness both of this council and of the city. So I will not be supporting the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Other conversation? Mr. Baskell.
I just wanted to say a few words about you, Mayor. I'm just very pleased that you want to do it for another 2 years. You've been serving your community with grace and compassion, and that's something that I'm looking for and really respect about you. And I know I've been serving on the council for 1 year, and there's one thing that I hear when I travel around and meet other elected officials throughout the state and region. They always say, what a great mayor we have. And I want to continue that, and I'm sure Councilmember Asher would do a good job as well, but I'm just really looking forward to another 2 years of your leadership. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be not supporting this amendment.
Thank you. Other comments? Sure that everyone's had a chance to speak. All right, it was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Neer to amend the motion to have Mr. Asher serve as mayor. Will all those in favor of that amendment please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed say no.
No.
No. No. Thank you very much. Then the question is on the main motion. It was moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to appoint Amy Wallen as mayor for the next 2 years. Will all those in favor please say aye.
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 And those opposed? Say no. Thank you very much. That appointment is complete. I appreciate your support and belief in me. Thank you. Election of the Deputy Mayor. Ms. Sweet.
Madam Mayor, I would like to elect Jay Arnold for another term as the deputy mayor for the city of Kirkland.
Second.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Ms. Councilmember Sweet and seconded by Councilmember Paschal to appoint Jay Arnold as our deputy mayor for a 2-year term. Any discussion? Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed? Thank you very much. Congratulations, Deputy Mayor Arnold. So we're going to have a 5-minute break to spend some time with our families, and we will get back to the real business of the city in just a short amount of time. Thank you. I did. He's so cute. Thank you very much. We are back in session after a quick break. The next item on our agenda is under communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. There are no public hearings scheduled tonight. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We also ask that not more than 3 people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to 3 proponents and up to 3 opponents may address the council. We do have a sign-in sheet. The first person to have signed in is Ken McKenzie. Welcome, sir. Good evening.
Technology. So I saw on the list of possible topics for the February council retreat was ARC. So I thought it would be appropriate to kind of review what happened the last time around and figure out how to go forward. So the review part is, first off, we did have this Proposition 1. It was in 2015. And 96% of the donors that contributed to the Yes campaign, 96% who contributed to the No campaign were from Kirkland and only 61% to the Yes campaign. There was a lot of interest outside of Kirkland in Proposition 1. The No campaign raised about $8,000. The Yes campaign raised about $63,000. And of that $8,000 or so, the top contributor was to the No campaign was the Columbia Athletic Club. And Wave Aquatics contributed almost $37,000 to the Yes campaign. So there was a real imbalance in the contributions to the campaign. But when the vote came in, it was 63% no and 36% or 37% yes. It's also interesting to note that there were 19,300 votes cast in that campaign versus only 17,000 and 16,000 in the city council campaign. So a lot more people were interested enough to vote in the Proposition 1 issue than they were in city council. It was an important issue to Kirkland, and they voted overwhelmingly against a metropolitan park district. And there's been a lot of discussion since then about, well, what did this really mean? What did it mean about an ARC? What did it mean about a metropolitan park district? And those of us who organized the No campaign said at the time that we would work to build a pool, an indoor pool, using a traditional bond, that we are interested in a fixed cost, well-known tax that would pay itself over a fixed period of time. And we'd support that sort of idea. And I think there's some other parts of that discussion. What we did not like was the Metropolitan Park District. We didn't like the way it was applied this time. And since then, the council has managed to change the law, the state law, to give a little more flexibility. But fundamentally, a junior taxing district is not a wise idea. And Metropolitan Park districts were invented, we believe, for a different purpose. They were invented for multiple municipalities to come together and organize parks, not for one city to figure out another way to tax its citizens.
Thank you,
so,
Mr.
ARC, yes. MPD, no. And this is a review.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Santos Contreras.
Good evening to all of you. Congrats to the newly electeds. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I've got to throw a parenthetical note in. I replaced Bob Neer on council in 1991, and now here his son, Tom Neer, is sitting there. So congrats to you especially. Congrats to all of you. Okay, I'm here tonight to ask the city council to request that the city staff recommend to council whether to name the Marina Park Pavilion after former city manager Al Locke. Several weeks ago, Bill Woods, Bob Neer, and Bob Ely asked the park board to name the Marina Park Pavilion after Al Locke. After receiving equal citizen votes for and against doing so, the Park Board decided to not name the pavilion after Mr. Locke. Instead, they decided to erect a sign stating the achievements Locke did as city manager. According to Park Department staff, the department has no plans to bring this issue to the City Council for consideration. Here are the reasons I think the City Council should take a hard look at this issue. Al Locke was responsible for helping convince Houghton to join Kirkland. He had the vision to help acquire the parks of which we are so proud. When the federal government made funds available for beautification, remember the Lyndon Johnson Lady Bird beautification campaign? He was able to trade city labor hours, talk about creative, instead of dollars, which allowed the city to develop many of the waterfront parks. He led the city efforts to acquire vacant lots throughout the city. I didn't even know that until recently, which formed the basis for all the great neighborhood parks we have today. He helped on the acquisition and development of the Evergreen Medical Health Center, which is a premier hospital in Puget Sound. I recognize he was a city employee, which is some people's objection. And some say, therefore, he shouldn't be honored. We name our parks after council people, prominent citizens, a former department, a park department director, and so on. There's certainly no rule against doing this. I strongly recommend the City Council ask staff to study this issue and make a recommendation to the council. Parenthetically, Joan McBride was not able to stay. She would have otherwise spoken out, and she wanted me to pass on to you her support for naming this after Al Locke. And also, Bill Woods would like to be here, but he's south. I don't blame him. He's enjoying the sun. And he also wanted me, some of these are his thoughts, by the way. He also asked me to pass on to you that he very much supports naming the pavilion after Al Locke. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Bob Neer. Welcome, sir.
Well, I am that displaced councilman for many years. And I did attend that meeting with the Park Board, with Bill Woods and Bob Ely, who was the retired fire chief. And we went to that meeting with in mind that we would recommend that the pavilion, which was one of Al's favorite projects, he prided himself when that pavilion was, it's the second pavilion there, not the first one, but he was real proud of that. And the pavilion be named after Al Locke. Well, when I saw the park board members, I realized that they were pretty young, and Al Locke had been city manager for 18 years, starting back in the 60s, retired in 1984, and none of the members of the park board really knew Al. So I took it upon myself to recommend they read the book, A City Comes of Age, which has 28 instances in that book that talks about things that Al did in his 18-year tenure with the city. And I had hoped they would read that, but I'm a little disappointed in what they're recommending, which is a plaque. And there are a number of plaques around the city, and my experience with them is they disappear, and they are forgotten, and they're not recognized. And putting a plaque up is not a proper thing. So I would hope that the council would ask the park board to reconsider and take action and name the pavilion after Al Locke. And I think the community and some of the old-timers around probably know Al well enough to say that's a proper thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Abby Kim. And Danielle Bay. Yes. Welcome, ladies.
Hello, my name is Abby Kim, and this is Danielle Bay, and I served as the committee chair for our Key Club Dance to Cure fundraiser, which was held on December 9th at the North Kirkland Community Center, and this was a fundraiser for our district project, the Kiwanis Children's Cancer Program, which Danielle will expand more upon, but we wanted to ask for the return of the 5% admissions tax for this event.
Hi. My name is Danielle Bate, and I work as the District Projects Director, so I work with Key Clubs all around the Pacific Northwest, and this dance was specifically held for those of the Seattle area, ranging from all the way up north in Linwood, all the way down to around Kent, and even Tacoma, I believe. And so what I just wanted to share with you guys really quick is kind of the missions of KCCP and where this money that we are asking for back is going to be donated towards. KCCP is a nonprofit organization that works with three hospitals around the area, Seattle Children's Hospital, Dornbecker Children's Hospital, and BC Children's Hospital. And so what it does is that it supports children's cancer research. And we as students made that our mission this year because we found that many areas within Seattle focus on cancer, but a lot of people don't focus on children's cancer, which can be really different. This doesn't mean just infants. This doesn't mean just toddlers. This doesn't even mean just me and Abby. It ranges from infants that are just born all the way to those aged of 22. And so what this funds is that it funds fellows so that they can continue research that's going to be specifically for children. And we just ask that we could donate the extra couple hundred dollars to reach our goal of $75,000 this year. We're well on our way, but we just need that little strive and it'll really make a difference for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. The next person to have signed in is Dennis Moran. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Dennis Moran. I'm the president of Fisherman's Finest. We're a fishing company up on Kirkland Way. And I've come here to ask for a letter of support from the council towards our federal congressional delegation, our senators and representatives, to help us get through a little problem that has come up with shipbuilding that we've been involved in. Real briefly, we operate a couple of commercial catcher processors up in Alaska. We've been part of leading the rebuilding of the fleet effort in the United States, which has been very difficult. A lot of regulatory roadblocks over many years, and there's a massive loss of institutional knowledge in terms of shipbuilding. So we embarked a couple years back, 8 years back now, on what is the largest private shipbuilding project in the state of Washington in nearly 15 years, up at Dakota Creek. In the course of building that ship, Dakota Creek Shipyard made an error. They ran afoul of an odd law, the only penalty under law is to disallow the ship from being documented. So the ship would have to be sold off to the Russians and could never fish in the United States, unless the one remedy available is implemented, and that's what's colloquially called a Jones Act waiver, but it's essentially a law passed by Congress, signed by the president, so it's something that's tagged into a bill that waives the penalty for the mistake, essentially. And we would hope that the council would support our effort in this. It's real key to get this done. It's very difficult at the federal level to get this done, but it really is important. It's important to save that shipyard, which will be really the beginning of 20 or 30 ships that will be built in Washington State, if that shipyard survives and this vessel can go into the fishery as planned. It's about a $75 million project, a lot of money involved, a lot of people's lives, a lot of jobs in Washington State. And so I would very much appreciate a letter of support if we can get one from you folks, asking our congressional delegation to pitch in and get this done for us. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've reached the end of our sign-in sheet. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the council at this time? Seeing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. And maybe out of those items from the audience, the Al Locke Marina Park issue, maybe the Parks and Public.
Yeah, don't you think we should set a committee?
Committee?
Yeah.
You okay with that?
Yes.
We just asked the staff to bring it back to us.
Bring it back to the council?
Yeah.
So?
I mean, it came from the council originally.
Yeah, that sounds pretty, pretty
okay.
Easy.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and I would add that we have to remember that our boards and commissions are advisory to the council. They're not dispositive. And we asked the park board for a recommendation. And their recommendation might be don't do it, but we should still get that back to us officially because we're the final deciders.
Yeah. Right.
So back to the council, okay, Mr. Triplett?
Yes.
And
yes, sir.
The rebate of the admissions tax, bring that back as a consideration?
Yep.
Okay. Council.
Yes, please. And then I think that Mr. Nixon's going to address that. You've got it, Mr. Nixon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had teed this up for council reports, but we can just do it now. Mm-hmm. You do have some information in your email and at your position, which is a lot of technical details about the the issue that Mr. Moran talked to us about with the ship. I'm very impressed with the fact that Fisherman's Finest is a Kirkland-based company, and we should be doing what we can to help our companies. And in this case, it's simply encouraging the Senate to pass a bill that's already passed the House, asking for a waiver because 0.4% of the value of this ship was work done outside the country. And the federal law says it has to be 0%, which is kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a single vote or an amendment to a bill going through the Senate can take care of this. And I think we should send the letter. So what I would move is that we direct staff to bring us back a draft of a letter for approval at our next meeting.
Second.
Thank you. It was moved by Councilmember Nixon and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to direct staff to bring back a letter in support of the
Jones
Act
waiver.
Is there any discussion? Right. Moved by Councilmember Nixon, seconded by Councilmember Sweet. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? Thank you very much. That is approved. Thank you for your work on this, Mr. Nixon. We really appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mr. Moran. All right, the next item on our agenda is under special presentations. City Manager, are we good? Okay, it's the award of the Kirkland Police K-9 Pet License. City
yes.
Manager.
So just a brief overview while we're bringing in our K-9 Officer Thor. As you all know, the City of Kirkland is now providing animal services starting January 1st, 2018. And so we have a variety of events that are helping mark the start of that service program, and one of them is to award the official first Kirkland license, and we thought it would be very appropriate to do that with our canine dog, Thor. And the Chief, Sherry Harris, is going to say a few words about the number that was chosen and why, and we have with us Thor and also his canine officer, Daniel Hopkins, here to accept the license.
That is a beautiful dog.
Oh, it really is.
So we're going to actually bring this up here. The ceremonial pet license for Thor is actually locked in our safe. And the really good news is that it takes two people to get in the safe. And we don't have two authorized people here tonight. So really good news that our finance department is secure. And we can't crack that safe tonight. So, but this is what the pet license looks like. It actually says 5 because Thor is canine 5 in our region. We work, kind of have a regional canine program, working dog program. And he is muzzled tonight because he works off of stress and adrenaline. And I'm sure there's none of that here tonight.
Going on. Yeah.
But Thor is a fantastic working dog. And Officer Hopkins has a very high success rate, gets a lot of tracks and catches a lot of bad guys. And so we just wanted to bring him tonight, and he will be canine 5 with the number 5 pet license.
Good boy.
Congratulations.
And then we will be doing some other ceremonial presentations at another time with some of the other numbers. Okay. Not all of that has all been worked out. So Kathy Cummings is working on that communications program, but we did go off without a hitch today and had calls for service, and they were handled, and it was fantastic. So it's all good.
Well done. Thank you. Officer Hopkins, thank you so much for bringing Thor tonight.
Oh, of course.
That means a lot to us.
Good.
This is a big night for us.
Actually, I think we'd like to see him a little more often.
Yeah, I know I would. So if we applaud, would that upset Thor?
What's that?
Would applause upset Thor?
Probably not.
It should be. He might get a little excited, but
he won't. Jerky treats.
He just wants to go to work.
Yeah. Congratulations, Thor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Just
good boy.
So while we're on the subject, just a quick update. We actually did get 3 purchased licenses at the counter today. So licenses 12, 13, and 14 have been taken. So if you wanted number 12 for your fan, you've lost that out. As the chief was mentioning, we reserved 1 through 11 for a ceremonial lottery. So anyone who's interested in getting the first through 11th license, which doesn't include number 5, which is going to Thor, sometime in the next few weeks, we're actually going to allow any citizen to apply for that, a resident to apply for that, and if you get a lottery, you get one of those. But other licenses can be purchased right away, so starting with 15 and up, if you would like to license your pet in Kirkland, you're welcome to do so.
Excellent.
Question?
Yes, sir.
So many of us already have licenses that don't expire till later in the year. But if we'd like to get a Kirkland license right away, can we do that? And would it like add a year onto our existing term? How does that work?
So you can get one. It will not add a year onto your existing term. If you choose to get a replacement tag now, it'll go to the end of your King County license. If you choose to pay a full amount, it will reset your start date for a year. So it'll be from now until the following year. So
great. Thank you.
But it's $5 for the replacement license.
Yeah.
Always working.
All right. Yeah.
Guys. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
The next item on our agenda is also under special presentations. It's the semi-annual Fall 2017 Service Award Recognition. City Manager. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So just from members of the audience, as you might recall, we only do this twice a year, and our usual time for doing the ceremony is the last meeting of December, and we had such a very packed agenda that we actually moved this item to the first meeting in January. And because of that, some of the folks that we wanted to be here aren't able to be here tonight. So this may actually play out over several different council meetings in the future. However, we're feeling fortunate because we think we got the best one here tonight. So here to tell you a little bit more about that is our Director of Human Resources, Jim Lopez.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the council. It is a very special night tonight for sure. And it's my pleasure to present you the Employee Services Awards. As you know, we do these two times per year, and it's for our employees that have served 20 or more years our city and our community. So it's a great event. As I read the employee's name, in the case tonight we have one recipient, that employee will come up, meet, and be greeted by the mayor and the deputy mayor for a photo, and then our employee will have the opportunity to be received by the full council. So thank you. Tonight we have one recipient, but it is a very special employee indeed. Very special because Frederick Ulrich of the fire department, who is a fire inspector, has been with the city 40 years.
Wow.
So come on up, Ed. Thank you very much.
Very much for your service to our city. We're going to do a photo first, if you wouldn't mind.
We have
the plaque.
Have our awards. Hold the award. Yeah.
So that is the
That's
award
it for tonight.
This,
as I said, we'll be bringing a few of the other award winners to a future council meeting.
Okay, so perfect.
The full list is in the council memo, so anyone who wants to know the other members, it's there. It's also available to the public.
Thank you very much. We're very, very fortunate to have longstanding people of such integrity working for the city and for the community. So we thank you, and thanks for being here to support your colleague. The next item on our agenda is the consent calendar. Before we have a motion, I'll ask Deputy Mayor Arnold to present the audit of accounts.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Since our last council meeting, which was 3 weeks ago instead of the usual 2 weeks, we have payroll in the amount of $3,219,558.77, and bills in the amount of $4,815,352.61.
Thank you. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Sweet and seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to approve the consent calendar. Are there any questions, comments, or corrections? Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Would you call the roll, please?
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Neer?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is approved. The next item on our agenda is under unfinished business. It's Ordinance 4633 and its summary relating to Verizon Wireless. City Manager.
Whoops, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Mayor. I think because we've moved quickly, our next presenter may not be available, so we may have to move this item back a little bit, if you don't mind, and
no,
come back to
it. No, not at all. Would you like to do item 12B, the Regional Transportation
yes.
System Initiative Update?
Yes, I would appreciate
update.
That if we could
Let's
move that,
that
on the agenda. That'd be great.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, so the Regional Transportation System Initiative Update is something that the council asked for. There's a elected officials meeting, which the council has asked Councilmember Asher to attend on behalf of the city council. We wanted to provide the council with an update of the staff work that had been done to date, and then for you to have a discussion and provide any input that you want to Councilmember Asher to attend the elected officials meeting, which is going to happen in a few weeks. So here to make that presentation is our Public Works Director, Kathy Brown.
Okay. Okay, so I'll go first, and Rob Jammerman is here for the next item as well. So good evening, Madam Mayor and Deputy Mayor and Council Members. Real quickly, I just wanted to review with you the status of the Regional Transportation System Initiative. The RTSI, as it's called, is a group that was convened by SCA and King County with technical support from Puget Sound Regional Council. Excuse me. The mission is to define regional transportation network and unmet needs and identify ways, excuse me, to improve performance on routes that connect communities. So basically the focus is on rural areas and routes that connect those areas to urban cities. The technical committee defines the network and has identified unmet needs, and then there's an elected officials committee that will provide policy guidance and recommendations for a legislative strategy. The elected officials committee that was originally scheduled for December and then was moved to January has now been moved to February. There are 1,300 miles, centerline miles of road that have been identified on the RTSI network. And basically, they're your arterial highways arterial roads. And there are many different classifications, but basically, it's the roads that connect communities. And their routes, particularly, they're focusing on routes from rural areas such as Enumclaw or Maple Valley or out in the Snoqualmie Valley that get into the more populated areas. There are some routes in Kirkland. There are 40 centerline miles worth of routes on the RTSI network in Kirkland, and they're depicted here. Across the whole region and on the entire system, the technical committee tried to come up with rough order of magnitude cost estimates, both in terms of maintenance and preservation and new capacity on these routes. And that was a difficult task, and I want to emphasize that these are extremely rough estimates. For maintenance and preservation, they looked at about 13 jurisdictions and their pavement condition index, their structures, their stormwater, street lighting, and other improvement needs. And they extrapolated that across the entire county, and then they took the percentage of that giant number that would be on this RTSI network and came up with $9.1 billion. I just wanted to be really clear that they didn't go out and assess all of these roads and come up with this estimate. It's super rough. In terms of capacity, capacity meaning projects that would improve performance on all of these roads, they looked at two sources. One is a list that's called the T2040 project list, or Transportation 2040 project list. And these are really giant projects that improve capacity. Kirkland had four projects on that list, and three of them are on the RTSI network. One of them is one of the ones that we talked about tonight, 100th Avenue Northeast, and another one would be 124th Avenue Northeast. Again, they put together these estimates to give an idea of the need. I don't want to leave the false impression that any particular projects would necessarily be funded through this mechanism. Then they also took a look at the local project database that's based on local comp plans. We've talked about our capital improvement program and our capital facilities plan. They take each jurisdiction's capital facilities plan and just total all those numbers that are in everybody's plans. And again, they applied the percentage, 43% of all of the roads and all of the systems are on this RTSI network. And using those two methods, they came up with a capital or capacity project cost list of $10.6 million. So the total need that was identified is about, The total need that was identified is about $20 billion. Which is, huge. And so the group came up with a list of potential new revenue sources. I want to be really clear on that $20 billion. Some of those projects that are in the local jurisdiction's capital programs are already funded, so it's not a complete $20 billion need. But again, they were looking for a rough order of magnitude number. I won't run through all of these possible new revenue sources. Again, all of the estimates are extremely rough. But what the group is really looking for now is whether or not there's an interest to move forward with this initiative and go to the state legislature and ask for any of these funding mechanisms, or see if there's an interest in seeking more direction from the state legislature on any of these funding mechanisms. The one other thing about the $20 billion back here on potential projects, what the group hasn't come up with yet are criteria. So in other words, if there is $20 billion worth of need across all jurisdictions that have roads on the network, and say $10 billion is generated from new revenue, there isn't a recommendation yet on how funding would be allocated or what would be the priority. But again, going back to the very initial reason for the group at all, it's to deal with deficiencies on roads that connect communities. And primarily where those deficiencies exist are on rural roads in unincorporated King County. The idea is, the concept is, that those roads are important to all of us because they get people to and from the urban centers and to and from work and so on. So the theory is everybody benefits from this transportation network. There is an elected official meeting that is now scheduled for February 2nd. The initial date, which was in December, the intent was to seek direction for this legislative session. That's pretty much passed. I mean, the time frame is too late now for that, really. But they will still be asking for the same kind of guidance, how to move forward, if to move forward and seek input on various funding ideas or options. They will be sending out the Puget Sound Regional Council support staff will be sending out a brief one-page summary in advance of the meeting. I haven't seen that yet. I'm assuming it will contain similar information as is contained in the council memo, but I haven't seen it. As soon as I get it, I'll forward it to you. So any questions?
Questions for Kathy? Comments? Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
So discussion. Are we going to give Councilmember Asher our thoughts on Kirkland's position in this initiative? Comments? Mr. Asher.
Just to provide a little bit of a framework, this is asking for $19.7 billion, roughly. In 2015, after 10 years of wrangling, we provided, or the legislature provided $16 billion for the state of Washington for, I think, about a 16-year program. Prior to that, in 2005, the transportation initiative, revenue raising initiative, was $8.5 billion. And then back in 2003, the nickel package raised $4.2 billion. So this is a huge effort with no real definition as to what goes where, how it gets prioritized. And I, from the first time I've heard it, it seemed to me that it's the county executive looking for a crowd of people to go to the legislature with him to ask for money. And one would think that it should be apportioned in some way similar to where vehicle miles traveled would be related, or pavement condition, or critical priorities, and I don't see that kind of an effort in here. So I'm skeptical of the initiative to just get us to go down and support the county in raising a bunch of money to keep from their roads from turning to gravel, because I think then it becomes our roads turning to gravel if you're not on this regional transportation network. This does not address Metro Connect's transit, which is a huge bill, which in my mind should qualify for state funding, because if you're putting trips in transit, they don't have to, roads don't have to be built. So it's missing some fundamental things, and it's not a plan that I can consider that is advantageous to the city of Kirkland, but whatever your guidance is.
Comments? Ms. Sweet, then Mr. Arnold, and Ms. Pascal.
Well, I don't disagree with all of Mr. Asher's comments. I agree with most of them. But, I have to share with you that, you know, having finally funded McCleary, the legislature is not going to be in much of a mode to listen to a lot of this, particularly not this session. So I would expect that the work has some time to come together. You know, I personally believe that we need to be working in discussions with our legislature about major tax overhaul. And to give them a list of items like this one that basically just nickels and dimes, and I mean, particularly given the fact that most people have not even seen the impact of the property taxes and the vehicle taxes post ST3. So I think we should be part of this discussion, but I'm really skeptical about any ability to take this to to, I mean, there's going to have to be a lot of negotiation down the road, just in terms of even being able to have that discussion with the state. So it's half-baked. I think it's honorable to work together with the county and all of the municipalities around moving forward, but let's not be insane with requests to the legislature. Larry just said it's just another committee going to ask money for the legislature. They're out there. Anyway, so I support the work, but I with a pretty long timeline.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
To Councilmember Sweet's comments, I don't think it's half-baked. I don't think we even have the recipe yet. I was part of a Transportation 2040 work group that was referenced here that looked at some of the parts of these issues and looked at the needs of the local communities. And these are projects like we were talking about in the study session. How do we deal with safety issues? How do we deal with choke point improvements? These are projects that are in our transportation plans today. And if you take a look at all those projects across the region with all the cities, and you take a look at our revenue authority, if we were to say, let's form a transportation benefit district, let's raise impact fees to the full extent that we can, let's do a parking surcharge, every single thing on the list. And in fact, many cities do one or more of those. But even if you said, take everything that you can up to 100%, there's still a gap. So there is a problem to go be solved. And I want to be supportive of beginning that discussion. And I think RTSI is the beginning of the discussion, because that menu that Kathy put up there, none of those revenue sources are what we're looking for. So I would like to go into this being supportive and open of beginning the discussion, but we're nowhere near finding what a particular specific proposal is to say, okay, we want $20 billion of revenue and we want it from here yet. I think that's going to take much, much more work.
Thank you. Mr. Pascal.
Well, first, I just want to thank Councilmember Asher for volunteering to go to this meeting. You know, I would agree. I mean, I think we all can agree that there's this real need in transportation investments on a regional basis, even statewide basis. And I think we all recognize the fact that any kind of revenue that comes out of this is revenue that could be out of our pockets that can be used for things that really could benefit the folks that are paying that from the city of Kirkland. I also, you know, I just have this fear of when the county is leading this process, that's kind of what you're going to see at the end of the day. So I'm more hopeful to see this process evolve into something maybe a bit different over time, where it's not, you know, the focus is the rural roadways, but kind of how do we start making a little bit more investment in some really key regional needs. So I'd be open to kind of seeing how it evolves into really looking at both cities and in the county areas equally, based upon, you know, where the needs are and how we best serve the citizens and our businesses. I also kind of get concerned, though, when we're starting new processes. We have the PSRC regional plan. We have the needs identified there. We have processes to assign money from the PSRC and that's the surface transportation funds. A very well-established objective criteria for transit, for arterial, for maintenance priorities. You know, do we really have to reinvent a whole separate process? I don't know, but that would be something that I'd be concerned about. So we'll see, I guess.
Thank you. Mr. Neer.
I agree with, I think, everything that's been said. I think we've swallowed quite a bit with Sound Transit and other investments we've made, and I think the county really drives those investments and has to show us what they're going to do for Kirkland, and I would like to see it unfold very positively for us.
before we start talking about a major investment in more remote areas, which I understand that there may be need, but this is massive. I also dislike the fact that it's been led by a desire to find funding, and we don't even know what the heck we're funding. So I would much rather see much time spent on what it is we really need and why, and come up with a number, and then we'd run to Olympia and get it, but we'd have a real good reason why we need it. This is folly to ask for money before you know what you're going to spend it on. I wouldn't do it with my kids. I won't do it with this. So anyway,
that's it. Mr. Nixon.
Well, my recollection of the genesis of this was when the county council members who represent the more rural districts were trying to figure out a way to replace the revenue that was lost when there were major annexations, like in Kirkland and Sammamish and the incorporation of Newcastle. Basically, the high-value properties that were in unincorporated areas have all been absorbed in the cities, which is state policy. It's grown completely out of proportion. If all they were asking for is help us replace the revenue that was lost by these annexations, this would be much simpler. But they apparently feel as though they need to get all the cities on board, because the only way they're going to do that in their minds is to take money out of the cities in order to spend it on the rural roads. And the argument is that people who live in cities drive on the rural roads from time to time as well. My advice to them would be focus on what your problem is, which is let's not try to solve every problem on every road in the entire county, incorporated and unincorporated. Let's just go back to the basic problem of the loss of revenue to the county because of annexations. How much was lost there? And let's figure out a way to replace that. Any one of these proposals here would replace that. And go back to what we did in order to enable those annexations in the first place, which was the annexation sales tax credit. And let's ask the state to solve just that problem rather than trying to bite off every transportation project in the whole county. And I think they'd have a much greater chance of success. I look at this list and, post-McCleary and post-ST3, it's very unlikely that the voters are going to go for this. And if you made these council manic so that they didn't have to go to the voters, all those folks would be voted out at the next election if they imposed all these taxes. And then this user fee thing, I haven't really heard what they mean by user fees. Are they talking about putting tolls on county roads? What is that? And I just don't think people are ready for that kind of thing. So my recommendation is, back to the drawing board, focus on what the actual problem is, which is county roads and the reduction in revenue from the county road tax.
So lots of advice there, sir. Good luck to
thanks.
You. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for being willing to serve. All right. So we'll go back to 12A. It's ordinance 4633 relating to Verizon, okay. City manager.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Thank you, Council, for your flexibility. So I might recall that our process requires two readings for a franchise agreement, and we had the first reading was on the December 12th council meeting, and although we had a presentation ready, again, given the length of that meeting, we skipped past that presentation and moved straight on to second reading today. So we'd like to walk you through the presentation, and then we're looking for a final action from the council on the ordinance if you're ready to vote. So here to give you that briefing is Rob Jammerman, our development services engineer, our manager.
Good evening. I'll make this quick. So this is the second reading of the Verizon Small Cell Wireless. We had the first reading on the one and only meeting in December. Before I go into this, though, I'd like to introduce, we have Ms. Kim Allen here with Verizon Wireless. She serves as our legal counsel. And there is a portion of this presentation that she will give, just a few slides to talk about what their company's doing. Just to kind of bring you up to speed, we work cooperatively with Verizon Wireless to develop our first small cell wireless master use permit. As I mentioned, this is the second reading. This is a 10-year master use permit, and it has the ability to be extended mutually for two additional five-year terms if both parties are in agreement. And at this time, Verizon Wireless has asked for only this primarily the south half of the city for this ordinance. At the previous meeting, there was a question about the regulations regarding visual impacts of small cell, and there was a memo that Jeremy McMahon and myself drafted, and that's in your packet, and it should answer most of the questions, but Eric Shields said that he would be able to field some of those if you have more. If you read through the memo, there's a lot of information there, but the high points are is that we do have the ability to regulate height and protrusions, impacts on surrounding neighborhoods, design compatibility, and equipment mounting and concealment. At this point, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Allen, and she can kind of walk you through some of the Verizon points.
Thank you, Mr. Jamrin. This is Kim Allen from the Wireless Policy Group, representing Verizon Wireless this evening. Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to speak to you about small cells. It's very exciting technology, and Kirkland has been a leader in adopting a small cell ordinance that allows this technology to be deployed in a very thoughtful way, which preserves the aesthetic controls that the city wants to have while providing a streamlined process to deploy these. And so the need, I think, is if everyone has their cell phones next to them, the need, I think, is pretty obvious. From 2010 to 2016, mobile data use increased 35 times, and 52% of American households are wireless only. Of the households that do have a landline, most don't use them, and most don't even know the phone numbers. They use them for their alarms or for their security systems or to field solicitors' calls. And this is the one. If you have teenagers, you can double the last statistic. Average American household has 13 connected devices in operation at any given time. So the reason why we're deploying small cells, which are different from towers, we have an existing tower network that provides the basic coverage that we've all come to expect. However, that network is stressed and it's congested, and there's more and more users using more and more data and using your phones in ways that we never used them before. It's become the remote control for your life. And so with that, we have to provide some relief to the existing tower network. So the small cells are small, two-fed antennas that will be deployed on existing light poles and utility poles, two small two-foot antennas, two or three radios, no equipment on the ground. That has been a choice that Verizon made deliberately to try to reduce the visual impacts of these, but these will allow additional capacity, which will solve the problems of slow data speeds, increased buffering times, dropped or incomplete calls, and ultimately, if you get enough users on there demanding enough data, you also end up with connection problems as well. So it is a coverage solution. Ultimately, if the network were to become too stressed out, you wouldn't be able to place calls either. So we deploy small cells for basically three reasons, all present here in the Pacific Northwest. Terrain challenges, the hilly terrains, the tall trees all interfere with getting a good signal. Water makes it a big challenge. Water bounces a wireless signal around in very interesting and ineffective ways. Tall buildings will interfere. And also large residential tracts where typically most cities did not allow the siting of wireless towers. We generally had hundreds of feet of setback from residential zones for towers. So it's been difficult to achieve coverage in some of those areas. And then now we've also had a shift in how people use their phones. People used to use their phones when they were for emergencies on the road, when they were out in public places. Now everyone wants to use their phones at home. They're using them for data. They're using them for work. They're using them to keep in touch with family and friends. They're using them for travel. The home is where the demand is. So we're trying to bring a solution closer to where people are actually using their phones in an aesthetically pleasing way. So small cells work with the macro network. As I said, they're attached to existing light poles, utility poles in the right of way, hence the agreement that you have before you tonight to provide permission for us to enter the right-of-way and attach to existing poles, generally Puget Sound Energy poles, although I think we are also designing for some City of Kirkland-owned light standards. We've been working very closely with staff to come up with a design that integrates and is consistent with your aesthetic vision. The basic components of a small cell, this is an installation in Green Lake. You have two-foot antennas, a fiber and coax conduit run. By the electrical codes, we are required to make sure that these poles stay climbable, so they have to have a conduit offset from the pole. There's also fiber to each of these poles to deliver the signal, and a small power disconnect box, low enough so that if anybody needs to work on this pole, that you can turn it off without having to call Verizon to come out and do that for you. So the city, if there's a pole strike or something like that, you can disengage our equipment without having to call us to do that. And there are also radios, generally two or three radios that are attached to the pole, as well as a fiber termination box. So there's generally one equipment box on the pole. These are some of the designs that we have for the City of Kirkland. Market Street, first project, these are light standards. These have gone through your zoning process and been approved after close work with staff and a review by them. As you can see, the antennas are fully integrated into the pole, a little bit broader at the top, and the radios and equipment are integrated into the base. These are what are being proposed for existing utility poles. Again, small antennas at the top, radio box, radios and fiber termination box on the pole, and nothing on the ground. So we are not adding any kind of clutter or additional street furniture to your right-of-way. As another view, these are photo simulations of what we're proposing on these particular installations. And again, you also have some taller combination transmission distribution poles. In that case, we can site mid-pole with the antennas instead of on the top, between the transmission and the distribution line, so that's what we're proposing here. All equipment will be painted to match, all antennas will be painted to match, and we will do our utmost, as we have been doing with communities all over the Puget Sound region, to make this integrate as seamlessly into your community as possible. So we ask tonight if you have any questions, and ask you to approve the agreement that Verizon has brought to you tonight.
Thank you so much. It's a treat to have you here. I miss working with you. Kim was on the Redmond City Council for, I think all of us know that. Anyway, it's lovely
it's
to have you
wonderful
here.
Wonderful to see all of you and to congratulate you all on another successful term as council members and mayor.
Well, we really appreciate Verizon working with our staff. Do we have questions for Kim? Mr. Pascal.
Yeah, perhaps I have an easy question here. I noticed in the proposed regulations, is that you only asked for a portion of the city. But this master use agreement could easily just been for the entire city. I was wondering, I'm just curious why we wouldn't just do it for the entire city.
Well, in working with staff, we ascertained that this would probably be the easiest way to deploy. These are the areas that we have identified in the near term, the 3 to 5 year build. And so that is the area that we wanted to target okay. for you. If you wish to award a citywide franchise, we certainly would not object to that. But I know that cities like Kirkland are being a little careful sometimes, and they want to make sure that what we're deploying is what we're telling you we're going to deploy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nixon.
Well, so I would like to follow up on that, though. Could someone from the city staff explain why the city asked for this to be less than the whole city? Rob, do you? What? Is there a reason why it's not the whole city?
So initially, Verizon came to us and said, we'd like to deploy small cell wireless west of Market. And that was the initial ask. So we said, and we were just learning about small cell wireless. And we said, yeah, let's take this off in a small bite-sized piece. And then as we transpired over the year, they said, you know what, we're not as far on our the design west of Market, and we think we're going to deploy up in Rose Hill first. So as we started to unfold this, unpack it, I said, well, I need a geographic area for the city. What's it going to be? And they just said, well, we'll go south. Now, the agreement does allow for the agreement to be modified if the public works director feels that they are meeting the intent of the franchise and you know, doing as they say, then we can do, like if they say, oh, we'd like to go another 10 blocks north or something, we have the ability in the franchise to do that administratively.
Great. And I think the reason Councilmember Pascal asked that and the reason that I'm concerned as well is, of course, we both live north of this area. And a lot of our neighbors ask us about concerns they have with the performance of the existing broadband services in those areas. And 5G, of course, has the promise of providing even better performance than some of the existing coax and fiber-based services. Is that in fact true? I mean, and when this is deployed, will this be a real alternative for replacing some of the existing technologies?
The initial deployments that we are working on the city with right now are primarily for additional capacity on the existing 4G network. The 5G technology is being tested right now. The equipment is not yet been designed. Designs have not been arrived on. So it's a little bit amorphous for us to start planning on that. Once we get equipment specs and the green light on commercial deployment, certainly cities that have made it easy to deploy small cells, because that will be the platform that 5G will come. It will come in a small cell type format as opposed to a tower format. So cities that have made that an easy process, as the city of Kirkland has, certainly would be in line for that. And as Rob said, we can come back, and as long as we have designs that are consistent with your aesthetic standards, staff can expand the franchise as we go without having to come back to council.
Just one last thing. So at the last meeting, I had asked for this report that staff did. I just wanted to say that the report was done very well and answered all the questions that I had. And thank you very much for a thorough job.
Thank you. Verizon prides itself on working well with the community and instructing our site acquisition consultants to avoid the obvious pitfalls of that pole in front of someone's picture window as opposed to the next pole down. So we have very clear training and instructions for our folks to pick the best spot you can.
Thank you. Mr. Neer.
I think the designs look fabulous, actually, for poles and technology. My question is more tangential. Does deployment of the small cell technology along with the macro provide any additional resilience for the city in an instance of disaster?
Generally, the macro network will provide your coverage in the event of disaster. The macro network, the macro tower sites are backed up with generators or large battery backup. To deploy battery backup on a small cell installation per pole would be something along the size of a refrigerator attached to each pole, and we thought that we weren't quite there yet. So in the event of a disaster, the tower network will continue to function. It will provide coverage. You just won't be able to videotape it and upload it to your favorite folks to view back east. You know, that the capacity piece will not be there until power is restored.
Thank you.
All right, other questions? Thank you very much. I think we're ready for a motion.
Madam Mayor?
Yes, ma'am.
I would like to move. I would like to move ordinance 046-4633 and its summary, granting Seattle SMSA Limited Partnership, doing business as Verizon Wireless, a Delaware Limited Partnership, a non-exclusive communications master use permit for the right, privilege, and authority to make use of the permit area for communications purposes.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Sweet and seconded by Councilmember Nixon to approve Ordinance 4633. Is there any discussion? Thank you for your help with us. Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Neer? Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Walling?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4633 is approved. Thank you for your partnership. Thanks, Rob. So I'm going to do a time check. It's 9 o'clock. I had some notes from the former mayor that told me that at 9 o'clock you take a break, whether you need one or not. So I wonder, I want to check in with the council. How do we feel? Do we, should we have a break?
Let's keep going.
You want to keep going? All right.
We had a break at 7:45.
Okay. Next item on our agenda, new business. It's ordinance 4635 relating to the new sick leave law. City manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So, as you saw from the staff memo, state law changed the way governments are required to provide sick leave, and we need to adopt an amendment to our code to update it to be consistent with that state law. But we also wanted to spend a little bit to tell you about the changes, given the council has a long history of caring deeply about the what we provide to our employees to make sure they're healthy and happy employees. So there are some changes that we thought would be good for you to know about, and probably future changes coming down the pike. So this is also a chance to give you a little bit of a sense of what's to come. So once again, here's our Director of Human Resources, Jim Lopez.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the council. I'm back. Thank you, City Manager. So I'm going to give this brief overview of the paid sick leave statute. Very grateful to Sean Frang in my office, who's our compensation specialist, for putting a lot of these materials together. And we did rely on supporting materials from the Summit Law Group, which I included in the packet. I thought they were very helpful summarizing the changes. I think the principal message that I'd like to open the presentation with is that what we're really talking about are changes to the contingent workforce. And this is the seasonal workforce, lifeguards, the folks that come in and do work mostly over the summer. There are a few hundred of them. They currently don't have these benefits. In the benefited population of the city, all the collective bargaining agreements and the management group, nearly all of the requirements in this legislation are exceeded by those agreements and by the APM for the benefited employees. So what we're really talking about is the group of employees, for the most part. There are some small changes we have to make, but for the most part, it's this contingent workforce. Because of that, there's really not a significant budget impact that we see in 2018. I really give a lot of kudos to Lynn Zweigstra, our parks director. She's really been very strategic about this because most of our seasonals are in the parks department. We've worked closely with Lynn to do some strategic forecasting this year, and we'll probably be back or through the budget process talking about what's likely in 2019 and 2020. There are some changes in the collective bargaining agreements. We'll probably need to do minor changes to bring them up to the law because there are a couple of places where it's below the law, very small instances. And I'd like to take a moment to preview legislation that's coming down the pipe. It's the new paid family and medical leave legislation. This is significant. It starts to come into play in 2019 where the state will be making assessments, and then in 2020, there'll be basically a new state program that we will either have to administer in the city or self-insure and be compliant with. So I'm going to take a slide to do that, but it's likely going to be another presentation maybe 6 months from now as the state works through how that program is going to work. I thought this would be a good time to talk about it. So very quickly, I'm just going to give you the overview, extrapolating 7 key points from the memorandum. What are the changes going to be mostly for our contingent population. They run from coverage. There is now coverage through separation. So there's accrual issues, usage, how you use it, how we have to notice and document sick leave. No adverse consequences. These are the policies we already have. They're now memorialized in the state law. How we're going to track and how we do separation. I also like to thank Michael Olson. We work very closely with finance on this too. For example, our tracking systems are compliant. They did some really nice work on that. So starting out coverage, it's all employees, including temporary and part-time. I've talked about the contingent workforce. The accruals are now 1 hour per 40 hours worked. For the benefited groups, we're basically 1 hour per 20-hour work. So we're significantly more than the state minimum. It will be 1 hour per 40 hours for the seasonal population. We're going with that. There's no cap on accrual, so you can't cut somebody off if they have a long day, an overtime. You can't say you're not accruing. You have to continue to do it. And it's okay to front load. We front load sick leave in our fire department protocols. All of that stuff is given the green light in the legislation, so we don't have to worry about that. In terms of usage, there is a waiting period. It's 90 days. In our contracts, we have to make sure that it's compliant in our contracts. For 90 days, a new employee coming in, they accrue from the first day, but you have to wait 90 days before they can use the sick leave. Now, if you have been employed by the city in 12 months preceding, you don't have a waiting period, which is significant for the seasonal population. You can carry over. The state requires that you allow folks to carry over up to 40 hours a year. There's been an expansion in the legislation on the reasons for use of sick leave. We have a very liberal sick leave utilization practice in the city, but the state has really called out things like mental illness, some family issues. They've called out some very specific reasons to use sick leave, and it's very helpful because now you have clear guidelines as to what you can and can't do. Usage increments, we're again ahead of the game in this regard for the benefited population. I think the state is the utilization is per hour. I think we allow it down to the 15 minutes. I think we'll use the hour for the seasonals. I think that's our plan. You have to give we are allowed to request reasonable notice, but it's a very specific and looked at and scrutinized by the state. The notice has to be consistent with the circumstances. So if it's a long-term request for sick leave, you know you're going to need it out in the future. The state can ask for, I mean, the city can ask for notice 10 days or more. But if it's an emergency, you can't. So you just have to do it as a case by case. The documentation exceeding 3 days, I have this in the memo, a little controversial. We can't require documentation inside of 3 days. Requests of verification outside of 3 days, it has to be reasonable. Again, it's kind of a case-by-case basis. And we feel we are compliant with our written policy requirements in the KMC with the passage of this legislation. And to the extent we have to make additions to the administrative policy manual, we will. But we feel we're good. The no adverse consequences, no discrimination, no retaliation. We have very strong no tolerance policies in the city practices, and we feel we're compliant there. There is an interesting issue on incentives. The legal community is going back and forth on whether or not incentives, annual incentives, are legal. We're evaluating that now. We don't have that in our collective bargaining agreements. We do have sick leave cash out, however, in the public safety groups, and the general feedback that we're getting is those types of programs are okay. They're okay. And we have proposals from other unions to do sick leave cash out upon separation as well. We feel they're okay. Tracking, like I say, I think the finance folks have done some really nice updates on tracking, on how we are going to administer our current sick leave to make sure it's compliant. And separation, this is a change, 100% reinstatement for qualified returning employees and qualified employees not subject to new waiting period if you come back within 12 months. We have to update our bargaining agreements to reflect that. Right now, I don't believe we have that requirement. So that's one instance where we have to move our policies up. So that's really, before I go into the new legislation, a summary of what's happening. And we felt it was important to bring it to you in summary form so that you get an idea of the substantive changes that are happening principally to the non-benefited population. Question. So, any questions?
Yes. Mr. Nixon.
Does the law or do our policies say anything about donating sick leave or sharing a sick leave? Like if someone gets cancer, can other employees transfer their sick leave to that employee?
We do. We have a shared leave program.
And so there's nothing in the law that requires changes to that or anything like that?
I think our program is compliant with the changes in the law, okay. So I think we left it at that.
Thank you.
Mr. Neer.
Not much financial impact. I note the 90-day mm-hmm. period, and with seasonal workers, isn't that kind of their time with us? So... is that the reason we don't see any significant impact? Or do we we get a large returning crowd every year, rehires? I'm not sure how this...
Yeah, I mean, you've highlighted the threshold questions. You know, it could be in the single thousands, maybe double-digit thousands. Would it really, in order to have a financial impact, I think the first question is, are we going to backfill? Because a lot of times in sick leave, we don't backfill it. It's a diminution in service for a short period of time. I think the lifeguard population is where we're looking most closely at, because if a lifeguard calls in, we may backfill a lifeguard. Because it's the first year and it's 90 days, those lifeguards that were here last year wouldn't have to wait to use it. But you still, I think we estimated they would accrue about 12 hours over the period. And using some back-of-the-envelope assumptions, we feel in the first year that it's not going to be that significant. But we are going to watch it, and we are going to model for the 1920 budget to see if it's more than a non-significant amount of money.
Just one follow-on, kind of operational question. It seems like we're treating that, that seasonal population a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So 40 hours to accrue an hour versus 20 and some other little things. Is that worth doing operationally, or does that cause you guys a hassle to do that? And
no,
is there enough money saved by making that distinction?
You know, I think it's not, we've determined it's not an administrative burden to do it, but we're taking kind of an incremental approach to the implementation of the law. So we started with that population where we had to, and if we feel it's justified, I suppose, in the future we could amend it up. I think once we get an understanding of what the implications are and what maybe the financial exposure long term is, I think we have the ability to amend it and bring it up. But we felt to get started we would do what the state minimum is and then see how that worked.
Okay. I think we're ready to move on.
So I thought I'd put a slide in on paid family and medical leave. This is legislation that's coming down the road, and I think the best way, I'm just going to do a brief overview, I think the best way to talk about it is it's a state-mandated and administered program. It's different from FMLA and WFLA. Those programs preserve your job, and they preserve your benefits when you need to take time off from work, federal and state programs. This program is basically a paid sick leave for qualified employees program. It's more akin to like short-term disability or unemployment insurance. The way they're structuring it, there's going to be a tax, and that tax is going to fund compensation with limitations. So if you're qualified, you would get X percent of your wage, limited, I think, to $1,000 a week, limited to the FMLA period, 12 weeks, up to 18 weeks in certain cases of pregnancy and other things. So this is another different state program that's coming to the city that we need to prepare for. The assessments for this program don't begin until 2019. Eligibility starts in 2020. But I'm working with Kevin in the city attorney's office and Michael in finance now. We're building a work program around what the implications are for the city, principally because there's an option for self-insurance. I believe we can make a proposal to the state as long as we're compliant with the minimum qualifications of the law to do it Kirkland's way. That has implications because all of our collective bargaining agreements and our policy manual, we've bargained those in the absence of this benefit. So our benefits may be richer because of the absence, and we want to make sure that we do a gap analysis and we do a kind of a structured approach as to how all of this is going to fit together. It's likely I'll be back with some thoughts on that as the months progress and we get our work done.
Excellent. Thank you, Jim. Other questions for Jim?
Where'd you get that picture?
This is an amazing slideshow that was put together by our friends in IT, Dimitri and Sarah, I believe, and we have these. We discover them. It's like a diamond trove. It's really great.
That's excellent.
Yeah, they're very talented, our design people.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, do we have any more questions, or are we ready for a motion? Mr. Arnold.
Madam Mayor, I move Ordinance 04635 in its summary relating to sick leave and amending Kirkland Municipal Code Section 3.80.100.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Ordinance 4635. Is there any discussion? Very thorough presentation by Mr. Lopez. Thank you. The roll, please, Ms. Anderson.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Neer?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Walling?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4635 is approved. Next item on the agenda is City Council and Regional Reports. Did want to make a note that at your place you'll find, well, maybe I should have the City Manager describe this thing. Okay. City Manager.
Yes, thank you. So, at your next council meeting, you're going to be selecting committee structures. You're going to be voting on that. And so there's two handouts that you have. The first is one that was put together in the past by Deputy City Manager Marilyn Baird. And it basically lists the topics, particularly on the front page, the city council committees, the current city council committee. So if you don't change your committee structure. So what the mayor and deputy mayor would like you to do is put them in priority order. So write down your first, second, third, fourth, fifth choice on the sheet. The second sheet that's attached to it, the longer fold-out sheet, just shows you all of the committees, including the regional committees, and it's really more just for your information to show you what the committees are, who staffs them, where the information comes from. So that's really the background sheet. But what the mayor and deputy mayor are looking for then is for you to fill out this one with your priorities, which will then be consolidated by them, and then they'll make a recommendation back to the full council at the next council meeting for how committee structure might look. And then, of course, that will be voted on by the full council.
Well said, sir. Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Nixon.
I love these charts, by the way, whoever put them together. Could we ask that after our next meeting, when we nail all these down, that we get a copy of the big one in electronic form for future reference? That would be helpful. Thank you.
It really is sure. Excellent work. Thank you. All right. So, City Council reports. Mr. Nixon.
Thank you. So not much happened since we last met, but immediately after we last met, there were a couple of important things. The last SCA Public Issues Committee meeting of the year was held, and as I noted in email, Councilmember Ed Prince of Renton was elected as the PIC chair, and Councilmember Christy Malchow of Sammamish was elected as vice chair. Most of us Kirkland Council members were reappointed to our regional committee assignments. But Councilmember Pascal was appointed to Regional Law, Safety, and Justice, which I came off of, so we still have representation there. And then, of course, on the 14th, we had the celebration of Councilmember Marcioni's retirement. And I'm sure we all agree that Jim Lopez and Kathy Cummings and everyone else who was involved in putting that together did an excellent job. It was a lot of fun, and thank you very much. In terms of things that are upcoming, remind everyone that this Thursday morning is the East King County Chambers of Commerce Legislative Coalition Breakfast at the Hyatt Regency. And then on the 10th is the Kirkland Business Roundtable at the UW Foster School of Business down on Points Drive. And that same evening on the 10th is the first SCA Public Issues Committee meeting of the year. The preliminary agenda didn't show anything that requires our discussion. But if anything comes up when the final agenda is issued, I'll email you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Neer, nothing to report. Mr. Asher.
You have one thing at your place concerning support of the I-405 express toll lanes that's been requested so that we can get this on record to a broader audience. There's the draft letter was put together by Redmond. It looks like Redmond, Kirkland, Renton, and Bellevue will be supporting these, and Bothell has declined to sign at this time. It's part of our legislative agenda. Would ask for unanimous consent to have the mayor sign the letter as a signatory on this letter.
This is reauthorization, right? Supporting reauthorization.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Pascal.
Just a question about the letter. I noticed in several instances they talk a lot about the benefits of the toll lanes moving more vehicles. I'm wondering why they didn't choose to use the word people. Are they not moving?
It was written by a lobbyist, a Redmond's lobbyist. But yes, I had exactly the same comment.
Okay.
It does make some allusion in some instances talk about people, but
yeah, it'd make me feel better if.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I don't think we are at the point of editing the content very much. That's the challenge with this.
So are we okay to sign on? Does this require a motion, or are we okay with head nods?
I think a motion would be helpful.
You always like motions.
I know. I'm sorry.
So I think that was a motion by Mr. Asher, yes?
It was.
I'll second it.
Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Nixon to authorize the mayor's signature on the letter of support for the I-405 Express Toll Lane Authorization Reauthorization. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed? Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing that up. Other items to report? Mr. Asher?
No.
Ms. Sweet?
I don't have anything to report either, but I just want to say to staff about Doreen's event. That was absolutely the most amazing thing in the world, and I know you all participated in one way or the other, and particularly in the bench gift to her. I can't thank you all enough. It's so great to work with you.
So,
thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
All of that was hopefully caught on record. She's absolutely right. That was just an act of pure love, what you did for Doreen, and it just was incredibly moving. It's very rare that the city of Redmond says, wow, Kirkland did better than us, but that was the night. They said, nothing like this has ever been done. They absolutely were in awe of what we did for Doreen.
And I have to add one comment. John and I were together the next day for a fire department ceremony, and John comes over and he says, that was great that you had Larry contact Frank. And I said Frank was the first one to respond to an invitation.
Yeah.
So
pretty powerful stuff.
It was pretty weird.
Awesome job. Thank you. Mr. Pascal.
Yeah, well, first, it's good to rejoin you all.
welcome back.
After my month off. Speaking of my month off, I didn't take much time off. I spent some of my free time visiting the fire stations and riding along with police officers on several occasions during my free time, and got to, you know, thank them for their service and hear a lot about what's on their minds. And so that was really feel privileged to be able to do that, and I enjoyed hearing about what was going on their side of things. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
First on the Doreen celebration, hats off to the folks at Studio East, mm-hmm. the kids that played our doppelgangers. I will note that the mayor is in her traditional garb that she was in that same evening, and really loved the fun that you had with those up there, because that was very important, because we certainly can't sing like those kids did. A couple of things. Eastside Transportation Partners meets a week from Friday, and I'd like to get council approval to have John and I represent the city until we can come back with committee appointments. And secondly, I had sent around the latest draft of ETP's legislative agenda. There weren't any substantive policy changes compared to what I'd circulated in December, but wanted to get approval from this group to support language that was substantively similar to that current draft.
Absolutely no issues here.
Okay.
Does that require a motion?
Well, we're going to bring you back a support agenda for formal adoption.
Okay,
so if I get head nods to include that, I'll just make sure we include it in there, and then you can
head nods.
Vote on it with the support agenda.
Excellent.
And if everybody is okay with providing direction to John and I, that you're in support of that agenda.
Madam Mayor.
Oh, yes, sir.
I think it's, we may even want to put this in our council policies at some point, but I think we should have at least an understanding that we all continue in our regional assignments until a motion is made to change them. And that way we don't have any question about whether, like, I'm supposed to go to the PIC meeting on the 10th and whether you're going to go to the ETP meeting.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It's probably okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Arnold?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. I have nothing to report. So we'll move on to the city manager's report.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. Just making a note of Councilor Nixon's request. So a couple things that I want to highlight. First, on page 237, I didn't actually do a slide this time, but the issue is the council retreat agenda. So on page 237, it includes the memo that has the list of topics that you had provided in the past. I would basically wanted to give one last call for topics, and then based on that, we'll come back to you at the next council meeting with a strategy for how to lay out time dedicated to each topic. At the moment, your list is fairly long, and what I'm likely to propose to you is that some of these things would then, and this would be again on the next meeting, some of these things might just be referred directly to committee, some of them might be consolidated, or we might propose to slice them, focus on ones that maybe have major financial implications or something for discussion at the retreat. So, but I'm trying to make sure I get the final universe before I move to the forum. So this is sort of last call for retreat items. And recall, there will be a council potpourri section where other items can be talked about at the end of the meeting. So,
Mr. Nixon.
Regarding the council potpourri session, the brainstorming, I think it would be useful if we got a reminder of what the format of that is. I know at the last time we did it, some of us submitted lists in writing and others didn't. And just for consistency, it might be good just to remind us of exactly what we're going to do so that we can be prepared for that properly.
Sure. Well, you've chosen to do it slightly differently each time.
Yeah.
So I can tell you that the consistent themes are an opportunity for council members to suggest things that they're interested in. You usually go around a certain number of times, and again, that amount has varied. Sometimes it's a couple times, sometimes it's many times. And then you have all of them up on the list, and then you, with the, what we call the famous dot exercise, you then go and say which ones you really want to talk about. And then based on ones that get the most number of votes, we then start allocating them to committee work or other things. So we can propose a structure based on the last one if you'd like. So that could be submitted in writing or could be just brainstormed at the moment of the council retreat, but you've done it several different ways in the past.
And one other follow-up question. I believe we have a list of all the previous brainstorming topics. Could we get an electronic version of that redistributed to all of us? That way we can remember what's been suggested previously.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Neer, then Mr. Asher.
Long list, and that brings to mind maybe future retreats and some discussion about how many we should have. I myself are in favor of as many as we can squeeze in our year. I think it's good to get away and to talk about a variety of issues. I want to add one more thing, and maybe for a future retreat, and that's potentially inviting a speaker and somebody that we view collectively that could be profound and help us to stretch ourselves and think about the world in a different way, and might help us break out of our day-to-day, keeping the trains running on time to think about, you know, some dreams that might help the city in the next 10, 20 years. Yeah.
That's a great thought. Mr. Asher.
The fire and police strategic plans are too big for the retreat, unless we have some, I would say, meetings with groups of council members ahead of time to go over those, because I think they're vitally important. It's where we spend about two-thirds of our budget, but trying to tackle the whole elephant in a retreat, I think, would be too much. If we can do some pre-meetings with small groups of council members, I would highly recommend that, and then we can discuss some maybe some questions that came out of that to see where we are. Going over the recommendations, Counselor. And the actions, the status of the actions from the recommendations may be the way to go through the briefings.
Is Council support of that, setting up those kinds of?
Those kinds of meetings?
If time is, if there's enough time. I mean, that's something we ask.
Mm-hmm. So just a reminder, what the intent then of the retreat is, you'll have you know, white papers or memos, however you want to think about it, for each of these topics. So part of the way we might be addressing this is give you each of the strategic plans, and sort of the unfinished would be a background memo. So here's the things on the strategic plan that we haven't got to yet. So, you know, checklists or things are in progress. And we also still have the committee meetings between now and then as well, where we can talk about, you know, in the fire strategic plan as an example, we know we're still trying to site and build stations. So we'd say, is this still the right focus? And maybe there's not a whole lot of other work that needs to be done. But I definitely want to keep checking in. And then the retreat's not the end. The retreat's the beginning, right? So if it starts to lead to other things, we can have additional meetings. So
the challenge here is that we have a council meeting 3 days before our retreat.
Right.
The meat in the in these two topics of these two strategic plans, even if you just boil it down to the recommendations section, is bigger than a bread box.
Yeah.
So I was trying to provide some kind of way of doing that, but I've got the time. Maybe others don't have the time.
We can certainly survey and see if we can find some.
Did I see you, Mr. Neer? Do you have a comment? No, okay.
We have done a fair amount of work, and we've got status reports that can be shared, you know, particularly with Tom, maybe not as much with John, but, well, of course with John, with whoever. But we worked pretty hard with both fire and police to make sure that we had a status report, or had a document we could look at with the, 88 items for fire and however many for police, and what our status is now, or what our progress is toward dealing with it. And I think that would be very helpful. I don't know what else you would intend to present, Dave.
That's up to you.
Mr. Arnold, then Mr. Nixon.
I think the biggest challenge with the retreat is we've got 9 or 10 topics here, and each mm-hmm. of them are really meaty. And whether we go with Councilmember Asher's suggestion that says there needs to be some pre-meetings on these topics, or we pick a couple that we focus on and defer others to committees or future retreats, I think the goal that we should be getting to is really having a robust discussion on some big topics, and we are not able to cover everything that's on this memo in a day. So it's either going to take some pre-meetings, or it's going to take additional retreat time, or it's going to take prioritizing what it is that we focus on, or maybe all of the above.
Right. Mr. Nixon.
With the fire and police strategic plans, of course, they're under the responsibility of the Public Safety Committee. We do have one meeting scheduled already on that of that committee before the retreat. And I don't know what's on the agenda for that now, but maybe we could use some of the time there to prepare some advance work. And then maybe schedule one other, but at least have the Public Safety Committee review and maybe prioritize the elements that should be discussed by the full council at the retreat.
Would that work?
Yeah. So on January 9th, Public Safety Committee meeting, the main topic on the agenda is the status report on the police strategic plan.
There you go.
So that will be something that will be ready, and we can talk about what might be available for the fire strategic plan.
Now, did we move the January meeting to the 9th, or is that the rescheduled December meeting?
No, we moved the January meeting to the 9th was okay. The direction that we took from the last meeting, because we canceled.
I don't have it on my calendar.
I do have it on my calendar, and I still have one on the 18th as well, but that might be a leftover.
Is it 8:30?
I can make sure you get it.
I have 9 on the 9th.
I think it's 9 to 10:30, but I can verify it.
So maybe some pre-work can be done at that committee and have a bit of the best of both worlds, because it is so rare that all 7 of us have a chance to talk about these big issues. So maybe that committee can help us distill down what we need to really focus on. Okay. Other comments about the retreat agenda? Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. So I'll come back with a more formal, structured proposal at the next council meeting, and then we can finalize it for the meeting on the 23rd.
Okay.
So, 2 quick clarifications that I wanted to make based on some of the stuff that happened earlier. The first, Mr. Lopez wanted me to actually say what several of us said at the presentation on sick leave, is we don't actually have a shared sick leave policy. We have a shared vacation policy. So we can donate vacation to other employees. We can't yet donate sick leave. So that's something we're going to be taking a look at. It is something that the unions have brought up, and so it's one of the things that's in a set of discussions we're having. But today, we can only do shared vacation.
It's a bit trickier, though, isn't it? Because you don't know if you're going to become sick and need the leave yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, the second thing is just check in with Lynn. I wanted to highlight that we would certainly never take away the council's ability to decide on whether or not to name something. So I just wanted to let you know what we were going to do, because there is a resolution the city council has adopted that lays out a process for naming a park or a facility after person. And what that section says is that the final decision is the responsibility of the city council. However, it says it should be referred to the park board, and it says the city council won't make a final selection until after it has received the recommendation of the park board. So our intent was to bring to you, here's what the park board said. Now, what would you like to do with it? So you sort of got that feedback. I just want to say it's a little different nuance than what you heard from the testimony. We weren't trying to not have you get that recommendation. We just hadn't formally scheduled it yet to come in front of the council to get your direction. So we will be bringing it back as you requested, but that had been our process that we're going to follow along. But we do actually have to have their recommendation before we bring it to the full council. So now we have it, and we'll schedule it for a future council meeting.
Excellent. Thank you.
And then, are there any other items you want to add to the calendar? I did get the other topics from the items from the audience already down. Anything else, though?
Don't see anything else.
Okay. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. So we are not quite at 10 p.m., so we have an additional items from the audience period in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing on our agenda. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We also ask that not more than 3 people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to 3 proponents and up to 3 opponents of the matter may address the council. And this additional item from the audience period will not exceed 15 minutes. Is there anyone who wishes to address the council at this time? Seeing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. And thank my colleagues for an excellent meeting. Looking forward to a prosperous and successful year of working together. Happy New Year, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.